You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford with January 24th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world, as will be the case next Wednesday, the 31st of January. Whatever stirring words may come out of the mouths of heads of state protecting the civil liberties of their citizens and their right to publicly protest against policies and actions they may disagree with are not, it should be assumed, high on their agenda. It is equally true when they speak of how such cases are handled in other countries, where their only criteria is whether the country in question is an ally or foe. This arguably has been true of all American presidents, but none as crudely as President Trump in his tweets supporting the spate of anti-government protests across Iran that began in December that were echoed by his mouthpiece in the UN, Nikki Haley. This was underscored by Haley's futile effort to get the UN Security Council to take up Iran's relatively muted response to the protest, apparently believing she could get it to pass a resolution of condemnation or threaten Tehran with further sanctions. She got neither. During a special meeting of the council she had called for January 5th, Haley pushed her colleagues to invoke Article 34 of the UN Charter over the reaction of Iran's security forces to the protesters, charging that, quote, member states cannot use sovereignty as a shield when they categorically deny their people human rights and fundamental freedoms, end quote. Her British counterpart, Matthew Rycroft, while acknowledging that the Council is, quote, empowered through Article 34, end quote, pointed out that Iran's actions failed to meet the qualifier of the article, quote, to investigate any dispute that might give rise to international friction. This one didn't. Trump's over-the-top tweets on the subject you couldn't miss hearing on NPR whenever you turn on the media. Today, at 20 minutes past the hour, I'm going to discuss the background of the Iran protest, as well as what's going on in Syria today, and the way Americans view those protests with former CIA analyst and Takes on the World guest Paul Pillar, which he explored in a recent article on Consortium News titled Gazing at Iran Through a Distorted Glass. With any country that, like Iran, has been the subject of acrimonious debate in Washington, writes Pillar, pronouncements by American observers about events in that country have more to do with politics here than with what is going on over there. So it has been with much of the spinning and interpreting of protests in Iranian streets. Some guidelines for intelligent, responsible, and useful commentary on those protests are in order and applicable, writes Pillar, no matter what are the policy preferences of whoever is commenting, end quote. Well, there's been another important string of protests that you haven't been hearing about lately, since unlike what has been taking place in Iran, they have been against the government of a U.S. client state, Honduras. Last December, NPR and the rest of the mainstream media gave considerable coverage to protests that took place in Honduras after what an apparent majority of its voters and the governments of the Americas, with a notable exception of the United States, considered to be a fraudulent presidential election when they returned to power Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was put in office through a U.S.-supported coup in 2009. The deeply flawed ballot counting process included long delays blamed on computer glitches, which saw Hernandez's early 5% deficit behind opposition candidate popular TV host Salvador Nasralla mysteriously disappear and have him reemerge with a narrow 1.5% victory. The vote was denounced by numerous observers, including the Organization of American States, which has called for new elections. The Trump administration ignored the call and quickly recognized Hernandez as the winner. While the protests have continued through this past weekend, there have been no reports on NPR, next to nothing in other mainstream media since the middle of December, despite the fact that more people have been killed by government forces in Honduras than in Iran. On Monday, Democracy Now! Broke through the silence with a report on last Saturday's protest and a comment from Salvador Nasralla, his candidate. Hernandez is scheduled to be sworn in for his second term on January 27th, Saturday, a day on which the country's opposition alliance has announced a nationwide strike. The leader of the opposition alliance is former President Manuel Zelaya, who was ousted in the 2009 coup backed by then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. One of whose emails made public called for him not to be allowed to resume his office. Amnesty International has accused the government of deploying, quote, dangerous and illegal tactics to silence any dissenting voices, end quote, while the United Nations and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights had denounced torture of detainees in military installations and said they were, quote, alarmed by the illegal and excessive use of force to disperse protest, end quote. But the U.S.-backed government has rejected a request by the Organization of American States to send a special delegate to investigate abuses. Honduran officials have downplayed the deaths, claiming gang members are behind the protest. Earlier this month, demonstrators opposed to the Honduran president took garbage bags full of waste to a U.S. military base, ripped them open, and strewed the contents at the feet of the soldiers on duty there. Their message was plain, wrote Judy Weber in the Financial Times of London. The English press has covered this very well. The base is a potent symbol of U.S. power in the Central American country, and the stunt was intended to present as rubbish Washington's endorsement of Hernandez as the winner of the November 26 elections. Moving on. The biggest concern at the moment, at least in Washington, across the Middle East, and in the capitals of U.S. allies and NATO, is most surely Turkey's ongoing attack on U.S.-backed Kurdish forces in northern Syria that began last week, which it has named in Orwellian fashion Operation Olive Branch. It is something I will also be speaking about with former CIA analyst Paul Pilar later in the program. Turkey is Washington's oldest and most important ally in the region, dating back to the beginning of the Cold War. And while the two countries have had their differences in the past, none has been quite like this one. Turkey's actions appear to be directly connected to the announcement by U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson last week that U.S. forces currently numbering 2,000 will remain in Syria and train an army of 30,000 predominantly Kurdish soldiers that will be based on the Turkish border. Speaking in a major Syria policy address hosted at Stanford University by the Hoover Institution, Tillerson laid out five U.S. goals in Syria: the defeat of ISIS and al-Qaeda, a U.N.-brokered resolution that requires Bashar al-Assad's ouster, a curb on Iran, conditions for the safe return of refugees, and the complete elimination of remaining chemical weapons. While the focus of U.S. military effort thus far has been on ISIS, Tillerson warned, al-Qaeda is still a grave threat and is looking to reconstitute in new and powerful ways, end quote. Well, if that's still the case, which is questionable, it has received more than its share of weapons in the U.S., which has long tolerated the presence of the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, because it was one of the more effective jihadist militias waging war against the Assad government. Well, additionally, the Secretary of State continued, a total withdrawal of U.S. personnel this time would restore Assad and continue his brutal treatment of his own people. End quote. Well, although the Trump administration has previously wavered on whether regime change had to be part of any political resolution in Syria, in this speech, at least Tillerson made it clear the U.S. would insist on Assad's departure. A murderer of his own people cannot generate the support required for long-term stability, he said. A stable, unified, and independent Syria ultimately requires post-Assad leadership in order to be successful, end quote. What the U.S. media and none of the politicians of either party have been willing to point out is that the U.S. has no business having a military presence in Syria or in any other country without that government's permission. That is particularly so when that presence is for the explicit purpose of preventing that government from exercising control inside its own internationally recognized borders. U.S. forces are in Syria without authorization from Congress, which has not even debated the subject, and they have no intentional international mandate from the U.N. to be there. Clearly, the government of the United States recognizes no country's sovereignty other than its own, and now it plans to add Syria to a long list of governments, many of them democratically elected, that our country has violently overthrown. Thanks to the absence of the military draft and the focus of the United States on a plethora of domestic issues, what the U.S. military is doing anywhere in the world seems of little concern to most Americans across the political spectrum. Indeed, when asked on Sunday's weekend edition his thoughts about the government shutdown, Senator Bernie Sanders expressed his concern for the welfare of the military in words that no doubt stunned many of his supporters, like myself. We are into almost 4 months of the fiscal year, and Republicans had not yet given us a budget, an annual budget, complained Sanders, and this is not the way you run a $4 trillion entity, which is called the United States government. Just the other day, said Sanders, the United States Armed Forces, the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense said it's impossible for him to do his job. It is responsible. It is wasteful. It is dangerous for the Pentagon if they don't have an annual budget. We've got to give it to them, said Sanders. Dangerous for the Pentagon? I'd like to hear Sanders' argument for that. This past week, Vice President Mike Pence has been visiting the Middle East, chatting with the heads of state of Washington's allies, but the main reason for his trip was to visit Israel and become the first U.S. president ever to address the Israeli Knesset. That honor, if one may call it that, is absolutely fitting, because the latest Gallup poll out last week reveals that nowhere in the world is President Donald Trump more revered than in Israel. That Israel also happens to have the most right-wing, unabashedly racist government in the so-called developed world probably has something to do with it. Over the past half century, most American presidents, beginning with Lyndon Johnson, have made support for Israel a hallmark of their foreign and domestic policy with various degrees of enthusiasm. Two that didn't, at least sufficiently to impress Israel's supporters, Jimmy Carter and the first President Bush, would later attribute their failure to win re-election to the opposition of the Israel lobby. For the most part, all of them permitted that powerful lobby, led by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, and its allies in Congress, to shape Washington's approach to Middle East issues, and in particular, those relating to Israel. Donald Trump has taken the relationship to a new level, as the New York Times' Max Fisher noted on Monday. Quote, within a foreign policy otherwise characterized by its haphazardness, he wrote, the Trump administration has pursued one issue with single-minded intentionality, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. President Trump's actions have consistently expressed a particularly American notion of being pro-Israel, he went on, but it is rooted less in the conflict itself than the United States' own culture wars. Bitter debates over terrorism and tolerance, writes Fisher, polarized along demographic and partisan lines, have primed a faction of Americans who express their identity in part through solidarity with Israelis and opposition to Palestinians. Politicians have long catered to this view, but Mr. Trump is first to make it official policy, Fisher points out. Recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital and threatening to close the Palestinian Liberation Organization's office in Washington, that never quite explained in foreign policy terms, resonate domestically, he wrote, as does his administration's withholding of $65 million from Washington's annual $125 million appropriation to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. That's the agency set up by the UN to provide basic subsistence for Palestinians living in refugee camps in Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, as well as the West Bank and Gaza, following their forced departure from their homes and villages in 1948 to make way for the new state of Israel, and in 1967 following Israel's seizure of the West Bank. It was not conceived that UNRWA would still be in existence or needed 7 decades later, but UN Resolution 194, calling for the Palestinians to be allowed homeland, was never accepted by Israel or pushed by the international community. The last president to support their resolution, let alone mention it, was John F. Kennedy. While they may have had some other things in common, when it comes to politics, Donald Trump is no Jack Kennedy. We pay the Palestinians $100 million a year and get no appreciation or respect, Mr. Trump tweeted this month, following the Palestinians' rejection of his decision on Jerusalem, which was clearly anticipated. His decision to cut the UN funding, which that tweet presaged, was actually a compromise, since his UN delegate, Nikki Haley, who behaves as if she also represents Israel, called for a cutoff of the entire $125 million appropriation, but that was opposed by Secretary of State Tillerson and War Secretary Jim Mattis. Israel, by comparison, gets and has been getting for years the equivalent of over $10 million of U.S. taxpayers' money each and every day, and if there's ever a discussion about it in Congress, it is how to give Israel even more. As New York Times columnist Tom Friedman pointed out 2 years ago, after a joint session of Congress that gave Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, 29 standing ovations during and after a speech calling for them to reject President Obama's nuclear deal with Iran, quote, said Friedman, the U.S. Congress is bought and paid for by the Israel lobby, end quote. It was, in fact, the second time Congress had given Netanyahu that many standing ovations. He'd received 29 such ovations at another joint session of Congress in 2011, 2 days after dressing down President Obama in the Oval Office as if he was an errant schoolboy. For those who would suggest that it is Israeli influence on the U.S. government in U.S. elections rather than that of Russia, which requires an investigation by a special counsel, I remind them that the appropriate agency to do that, the Justice Department and its Foreign Agency Registration Agency, is one of Israel's most important occupied territories in our nation's capital. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
The Palestinians cannot force major changes in the policies of the Israeli government that continues with the same colonial, apartheid-like policies that have defined Zionism since the 1947-48 creation of Israel and the dismemberment, disenfranchisement, and dispersal of the Palestinians. But 1.5 million Palestinians of 1948 have become 9 million or so today, and they do have the power to do one thing, whether they live in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, as Israeli citizens inside Israel, or throughout the diaspora around the region and the world. They can and must re-legitimize their national leadership into a single movement that listens to all views, represents them legitimately, reaches policy decisions on the basis of serious consultations and consensus that allows Palestinians to speak in a single voice and engages diplomatically around the world with the full support of Palestinians. None of these dynamics exist today, which is why the current leadership of the PLO under Mahmoud Abbas is not taken seriously in the region or internationally, least of all by the majority of Palestinians themselves, who have looked elsewhere for leadership in the years since the Oslo process proved to be a failure and Yasser Arafat started to lose his credibility. The leaderless condition of the Palestinian people today is reflected in how the three most dramatic examples of public political action in recent years have occurred without any meaningful input from the PLO or from the Palestinian Authority, which administers limited services in regions in the West Bank and Gaza where Israel gives its permission to do so. Those three examples are the current campaign around the world to support Ahmed Tamimi, the 16-year-old girl from a West Bank village who was detained in an Israeli jail pending a possible military court trial because she resisted Israeli occupation and slapped an Israeli soldier. The weeks of spontaneous popular protests last summer in Arab East Jerusalem, when tens of thousands of Palestinians there defended their holy sites at the Haram al-Sharif, and the ongoing boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement by civil society to pressure Israel to stop its mistreatment and human rights denials of Palestinians in the three arenas of occupied Palestine, the State of Israel, and the diaspora. Hamas's challenge to the PLO leadership in Gaza is another sign of the PLO's delinquency in protecting, representing, or leading the Palestinians. It is difficult now to create a whole new national leadership given the fragmented nature of the Palestinian community. Yet the cohesion that all Palestinians feel, wherever they live, also makes it feasible to at least start consultations amongst themselves to find a way out of the current nightmare by giving fresh blood and new life and legitimacy to existing PLO organs. There is no reason why we should suffer this ghastly fate of being plagued by a colonial Zionist Israeli state that steadily eats up our land, ignored by a mostly caring world that is otherwise preoccupied by more pressing issues, and abandoned by a Palestinian leadership that has become powerless, dependent on donors, docile, a purveyor of empty cliches, and largely incoherent. Such situations might lull some observers to see the end of the Palestinian issue, while a more likely conclusion would be that this low point will mark the start of a process of rebirth for the 9 million Palestinians who have never stopped struggling and working for their national rights since the 1930s. They are certainly not going to stop now, regardless of the poor quality of their current leaders. That was an analysis of the current crisis in leadership in Palestine, written by Professor Rami Khoury of the American University in Beirut. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, which is another of the conversations that a group of Boston area travelers had on their trip to Palestine, Israel, through the Gerelte Foundation. They sat down with Ray Dolphin of the United Nations Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, assigned to Palestine, Israel. The UN plays a limited but critical role in maintaining the daily affairs of the Palestinian people living under occupation. Ray Dolphin discusses that role in this informal conversation.
Okay, so there's OCHA. It's the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Bit of a long-winded title, but it's the humanitarian arm of the UN. So it's not only in what we call the occupied Palestinian territories. It's a global UN organization, and it was set up in the 1990s to coordinate response after conflict or during conflict, natural disasters and wars. So, for example, there probably will be an OCHA mission following the hurricane to the Caribbean once it pass, that's the type of the disaster response, to coordinate it, not to. Actually, Israel is a member of the global response. They've got quite good experience, I think. But that's after natural disaster. And then there are certain offices where it's meant to be temporary, because the whole emergency humanitarian context is supposed to be temporary, but there are places like Afghanistan and Syria, which are quite long-term missions, as you can imagine, particularly Afghanistan. Yemen, we have a mission for Yemen at the moment. And here is a little bit different, because we don't have a natural disaster, and we don't have war as such. We have wars in Gaza or conflicts. So this is called a complex emergency, and it's here what we say, basically all of the issues here are as a result of violations of international law, particularly international humanitarian law. We have international humanitarian law and international human rights law, but we do the international humanitarian law, which means here technically this is a very easy problem to solve, the Israeli-Palestinian, because it's a small area, small numbers involved, relatively well-off area, particularly on the Israeli side. And there is, there is an internationally approved resolution to the conflict, which in theory everybody has signed up to, with the exception perhaps of Hamas, but the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the international media. And that's the two-state solution, which means there's supposed to be a Palestinian state in the West Bank, with some type of shared capital in Jerusalem, and then some connection with Gaza, which is stuck over on the other side. And that's been the official position for the international community for probably the last 30 or 40 years, and it's been the official mechanism, if you like, since the Oslo Accords in 1994, which we look at in more depth. However, as you probably know, and you'll certainly see in the next 10 days, the reality on the ground is rather different, to the extent that although there's no... Last week we had the Secretary General here. He was sitting exactly where you were. We were doing the same briefing. He said publicly, "There's no Plan B to the two-state solution." But in practice, on the ground, it doesn't look, to put it mildly, very healthy at this stage. To the extent that a lot of people, including I must say myself, unofficially, would say that it's gone. And the fact that there's no Plan B is a problem. Now, you will hear, and probably people like Mas and Kumsi will, there are Palestinians who talk about a one-state solution, and there's lots of variations on that, federation, confederation, whatever. I don't have a problem with it. In many ways, it's a more fairer or perhaps equitable solution than a two-state solution. The only problem I have with it is I don't think it's ever going to happen.
Seems that.
So the idea, if we're stuck between a failing, which I think was possible, two-state solution, I don't think it was necessarily a just solution. I don't think there is a just solution to this, but it was at least a reasonable solution. But if it's gone, which I think it is, and the one-state solution doesn't look, then we're stuck with indefinite occupation, which I suspect is going to be the scenario, at least for the foreseeable future. Who knows? Nobody can tell the future, as you know, and things are changing in the region and globally, but for the foreseeable future. That's, of course, not the UN position. The UN position still is no Plan B or Plan A, which is the two-state solution, but informally, and perhaps this shouldn't be broadcasted. No, it's okay, that's true. Informally and off the record, most people are losing hope in it. And certainly most Palestinians are losing hope in it.
Because
that's a sense that we had. You know, we saw you at the beginning of our trip in January.
Yeah.
The sense that I had from that trip was that Palestinians are much more concerned about having decent lives than additional aspirations to a separate state.
Well, they don't.
The younger ones.
Yeah, they don't see it coming. So, what people are doing, I think increasingly you'll see Palestinians go down the civil rights or equal rights. Okay, you don't want to give a state. We won't ask for a state. All we want is the same rights as you, which will take it in a different area and will be much more difficult to argue against.
You talked to Eve Spangler, as I recall. She comes every year to Boston College.
Yeah, yes,
and
correct.
That's exactly, you know, she's got the book that she's made that case exactly the same when you just
Well,
read.
I think that's the way it's going to go. As the two-state, I mean, we seem to have a peace process of, not a process, but something of sorts with President Trump. And who famously said, one state, two state, whatever you're having, I'll have it, or whatever. So we don't know what that means. Frankly, it doesn't look like it's going to amount to very much already. So the US is still the most important outside actor when it comes to here. The European Union is the pair, the expression there, the pair, but not the player. The European Union, well, actually the US puts in quite a lot of money as well, but the European Union also has a vested interest. Of course, it's on Europe's doorstep, I think, but they basically step aside and let the US drive things. And we have what's called the quartet, supposedly as the holders of the process, and that's the US, the EU, the Russian Federation, and the UN, which is a bit odd because all of the others are in the UN anyway. So, but effectively it's the US. So if this US initiative doesn't lead to anything, I don't know. I mean, there is no Plan B, partly because they don't know what Plan B is, but also because to admit now that Plan A has failed is a huge admission. All the money that went in, all the energy, all the diplomatic activity, and if after 20, and it is almost 25 years now, you admit that it's all been for naught, then there should be some accountability. So anyway, just to say that we're not in a particularly good situation. And I'm talking mainly of the West Bank because, and we shouldn't forget Gaza, and we look at Gaza first, but ultimately Gaza will either sink or swim, almost literally, depending on what happens in the West Bank, because the West Bank is where it's going to, the particularly Tuesday, is going to succeed or fail. And Gaza has no future in and of itself. It needs to be connected with some other, whether the plan of the two-state solution is that it should be connected with the West Bank. The other alternative is to connect it with Egypt. Egypt clearly doesn't want that, but where it is now, and maybe that's a good thing, let's quickly start with
this is where we are. We're here in East Jerusalem, which you can see is the narrowest part of the West Bank, and here's the Gaza Strip over there. Now, when we talk about, we refer to the occupied Palestinian territory, singular, and the reason is that the West Bank and Gaza are supposed to be one territorial unit. Now, there's an obvious problem when you look at the map in that Israel is in between. The sovereign state of Israel splits the two. In 1947, when we had the partition plan, and there was supposed to be an Arab state and a Jewish state, the West Bank did have a link to actually Jaffa here, but that didn't happen. The Gaza Strip is as a result of the first war. So what we have is we have territorial separation. Now, under the Oslo Accords, there was supposed to be a territorial link. The suggestion was from here to here. It's only 40 kilometres, so it's not far, and the distances here are not very far. And it would go through Israel, so probably a road or a fence or a tunnel or a bridge, which would go through Israeli territory, but you could technically have some type of bus or train that starts here, just passes through and comes here. And while it goes through Israel, it's under Israeli control. It's transiting, basically. But it would allow movement in both directions, and also for goods, some type of road connection or something. And that was never implemented. So the Gaza Strip has been increasingly separated from, and there's been additional problems. In 2007, we had effectively a short-lived civil war in Gaza between Hamas and the Fatah, or the Palestinian Authority, which Hamas won. And since then, in addition to physical separation, we have political separation because the two entities are not under the... We have the Palestinian Authority in control of some of the West Bank and Hamas in control of Gaza. So there's a political divide as well, which doesn't help. And as far as the international community is concerned, Hamas is a terrorist organization, so nobody speaks to them. So, for example, when the Secretary General went last week to Gaza, he didn't meet with anyone from Hamas. There was no liaison. I mean, there's de facto a liaison, but so he went. To all intents and purposes, Hamas rules the territory, but nobody speaks to them. Now, since the Hamas takeover, there's been certain consequences. One is the Israelis have imposed a blockade on Gaza, which has eased somewhat. But what it means is it's sealed off on the land side, fenced in. And by sea, at least Gaza has the sea, access to the Mediterranean. You can only go 6 nautical miles out. And then it's patrolled by the Israeli Navy. And they will fire at or confiscate or any boat that tries to go beyond that. So the fishing industry in Gaza has pretty much collapsed. We've also had three, effectively, wars since. One in 2008-2009, one in 2012, and I was going to say the last, we hope it's the last, but at least the latest was in 2014,
which was the most severe. So we had over 2,000 people killed, we say mainly civilians. And we had 100,000 people homeless, 18,000 homes destroyed or severely damaged. There's 2 million people in Gaza. It's one of the most densely populated places in the world. And of the 100,000, there's still 30,000 displaced 3 years later because their homes haven't been. One of the difficulties is getting construction. Well, one of the difficulties is funding, as always. And that is a problem because this is a long-term issue. There's donor fatigue. And, of course, we have other regional demands. We have particularly Syria and Yemen and Egypt and Libya. So it's not the only conflict in the area. So we've had those three conflicts. The other issue is that Gaza has a border with Egypt. Israel clearly wishes that Egypt would take responsibility for Gaza. They were in control of Gaza between 48 and 67. Egypt has no intention of it. Egypt has 90 million people of its own, a huge population. Lots of poverty, lots of unemployment. The last thing they want is another 2 million to be responsible for. And anyway, they are correct. As far as we're concerned, Israel is the responsible. It's up to Egypt, it's up to Israel to open the crossings to allow access between Gaza and West Bank. It's not up to Egypt to open their crossings here to allow access between Gaza and Egypt, because Israel is the duty bearer here, not Egypt. And that's because, as far as the international community is concerned, the UN, Israel is still the occupying power in Gaza. It's true they're not physically inside anymore, but as long as you control the border and the airspace and the sea, effectively, you are the occupying power, so you are responsible for the welfare, and you're responsible for allowing people in and out of Gaza. Since 2013, we had the overthrow of President Morsi in Egypt and the arrival of first General Sisi and now President Sisi. Now, General Morsi was part of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas is part of the Muslim Brotherhood. So for that year, there was good relations between Egypt and Gaza. Since the arrival of General Sisi, there's very bad relations between the Egyptian authorities and Gaza. Among other things, the Egyptians say Hamas was involved in the troubles in Gaza. Not just, they say they were actually involved in 2013, which is a bit far. But in the Sinai here, we have an insurrection, we have an ISIS-type group, and according to the Egyptians' authorities' claim is that Hamas is supporting them, and as a result, they've closed the border, effectively. It's been closed, effectively, for the last 4 years, so it's very difficult for anyone to leave from Gaza to Egypt. And for example, Gaza fishermen used to go down here to fish. They don't allow them anymore. They've closed all the smuggling tunnels. There used to be lots of smuggling tunnels. They've closed those. So effectively, we've got two blockades on Gaza, one by Israel with some easing and one by Egypt. So the Rafah crossing here is almost entirely closed. It used to be the main access point for Gazans to leave. And if that's not bad enough, we have increasing issues between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. The international community's position is that Hamas is illegitimate. It's a terrorist organization and it took over by force. In itself, that's correct, but Hamas did win the elections in 2006 democratically, and there was a short-lived unity government, and there's supposed to be reconciliation. So, recently, what the authority in Ramallah is putting the squeeze on Hamas. So, for example, they're no longer paying for the electricity in Gaza. There's a Gaza power plant which needs fuel, which Ramallah used to pay for, which they're no longer doing. And Gaza also gets some electricity from Egypt for the southern part. And it also gets electricity from Israel, which the Palestinian Authority used to pay for it. Somebody needs to pay for it. And the PA has told Israel that they're no longer paying for the electricity for Israel. So, understandably enough, Israel has cut back on the electricity to Gaza. And the power plant isn't working most of the time. So, in the summer, we had power cuts, or let's say, for most of the summer, for a lot of the summer, it was only 2 hours of electricity a day in Gaza. So, that's it is pretty impossible, and there's 2 million people living in this space. One of the consequences of the electricity not working is that the sewage treatment plant doesn't work because it needs electricity cycle. So, what they're doing and what they're having, they're discharging the sewage into the sea, either untreated or partially treated, with the result that Gaza beaches were closed for most of the summer, and we had the first case of a child dying after swimming and ingesting contaminated whatever, and that's the first documented case. That was a few weeks ago. The prevailing currents are north, as we know the old adage, excuse my French, but ships respect no borders. So the Ashkelon beach had to be, which is in Israel, had to be closed, and the Ashkelon sewage treatment, desalination plant was contaminated for a while. So that's clearly something that benefits no one. This. But that's to put the squeeze on Hamas. I mean, the PA has some legitimate in the fact that Hamas most people in Gaza don't pay for electricity because they can't, but when they do pay, Hamas collects it and doesn't send the money to Ramallah. So, but without going into who's blame or everyone's to blame, of course, it's the people on the ground who pay the price.
Who is paying for the 4 hours a day rate?
Well, Israel still supplying. They didn't totally. They just cut down the PA, so they're getting some, and then they managed to procure some fuel through Egypt. I think United Arab Emirates paid for, and we pay for some of the UN for the emergency, especially for the hospitals. Now the hospitals are almost dependent entirely on generators. They're supposed to be backup generators, but they're working most of the time. There's a lot of elective surgeries which have been cancelled because they can't operate or they don't have enough fuel to operate, so they're prioritising, obviously. And another thing the PA has done recently, most people who leave Gaza to Israel or through Israel are medical patients. There is a health service in Gaza. It's actually quite a good one, but it's rather run down and it's obviously stressed. Now, particularly for cardiac and cancer cases, you have to leave, and you either go to Egypt, which you can't anymore because the crossing is closed most of the time. So you can either go to Israel or you can come to East Jerusalem, and there are good Palestinian hospitals in East Jerusalem. Now, obviously, to go to East Jerusalem, you have to cross Israel. And to cross Israel, you need a permit. So, who pays for it? The Palestinian Authority pays for Gaza patients if they're referred to come to hospitals in East Jerusalem and the cardiac cancer and eye. There's an eye hospital here as well. And some go to Israel, but most come to East Jerusalem hospitals. Some go to Jordan as well. Now, the PA has also been cutting back on the payments for referrals. And that's an issue as well. So we've also had cases. WHO every month brings out a report on referrals from Gaza. We have had cases of patients dying in the last few weeks because they didn't get permits or because they couldn't get referrals. There is an additional problem. Cancer patients, particularly breast cancer patients, there was a big backlog. There was a there was a demonstration. This is back in the end of last year, so there was a bit of an increase on that. And then earlier this year, there was, I can't remember if it was the patient herself or an accompanier, because a lot of patients who come need an escort. They're too young, or they're too old, or they're too weak. According to the Israeli authorities, was caught at the border carrying some type of weapons-grade thing, which the Israeli authorities say that Hamas was using this woman to smuggle stuff through. That may be correct. So that also doesn't help.
They're probably anecdotes.
Sorry?
Anecdotes, at least.
So yeah. It wasn't as reported. So, and there are cases of Hamas using patients or business people to bring stuff in and out.
Right.
So that doesn't help. I mean, nobody's saying that Israel doesn't have genuine security issues. So, but that obviously doesn't help if that's the case with getting people out. So anyway, to summarize, the situation in Gaza is dire. 80% of people are dependent on some type of foreign assistance. And if it didn't have this type of assistance, it wouldn't survive. And in fact, I'll just show you. We did do in 2012, we brought a report called Gaza 2020, meaning the year 2020, a livable place, questioning if the Gaza Strip would actually be inhabitable in 8 years' time. That was in 2012. It was updated this year, 5 years later. So we've updated some of the main indicators. So by 2020, we'll have 2.2 million. Another 0.2 million people, and that's the economy. The estimate for the economy, gross domestic product per capita. Now, would just be over 1,000, which actually is less than it was in the 1990s. The Economist brought out a report on Gaza, on the Palestine, for 50 years, and they said, the Israeli economy, I think it's $35,000 per year, which is like France. Obviously, Israel is a developed country. The West Bank is $3,000 or $3,500 a year. That's the difference, which is like Egypt. And Gaza, which is this, is like Burkina Faso. So what you have is you have an African country, a rich European country, and a Middle East country, economy rather, living side by side. The employment rate is 42% at the moment. That's the official one's higher, and the prediction is it'll be higher into 2020, and with youth employment at 60%, which is the highest in the world. What you have increasingly, there's a lot of people in Gaza going to university, which sounds good in itself, but frankly the reason a lot of people go is because, as you're not unlikely to get employed, you might as well prolong the thing. But all it means is that 3 years later you have even more educated people unemployed. Health, 1,000 issues, but these are not necessarily 1,000 doctors needed by 2020. Education, by the way, for some reason it's not for 20, but by 2030 there'll be 900 additional schools needed by 2030. Housing, there's already a deficit of 120,000 housing units. That's the thing. But the most important or critical issue is water, because there's only one resource in Gaza for water. There's no rivers, streams. There's an aquifer. The only reason it can support 2 million people at all is there's actually quite a substantial aquifer, which actually goes all the way up to Tel Aviv, or nearly to Tel Aviv. And the problem with that is it can't support 2 million people. So it has been, the water is being extracted and used faster than it's been replenished. And as a result, the sea is has been infiltrating, because of course it's on the coast, so the seawater infiltrates. And the projection is that this infiltration will be irreversible by 2020. And already WHO says that drinking water and gas, only 2% or 3% is potable. By 2020, none of it will be potable. You have to either boil or desalinate. There are desalination units in Gaza, which are also affected by the electricity cuts, of course. But short of a major seawater desalination plant being installed, that's going to be the critical issue. So, in addition to the humanitarian political issues we have now, very soon, in 3 years, we're going to be faced with this critical issue. So we look mainly at the West Bank, but clearly the situation in Gaza is becoming more and more critical, with no obvious solutions on the horizon. It is a disaster, and it's going to be more of a disaster. And obviously, the only solution going back to this is to somehow link it. Well, you can't really say this, but if the resource is not provided, then it's hard to see. Most people in Gaza, especially most young people, would probably leave if they could, but they can't. There is some smuggling. There are Gazans getting on the boats from Alexandria to Europe. But even if they do, they're way down on the pecking order. It's Syrians and others who have the priority, obviously. But there is some evidence of people. But physically, they can't. The Egyptians, the last thing the Egyptians do, will open the borders because they're afraid they'll stay in Egypt. So, unless there's some way of reuniting the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, then it's difficult to see how it's going to be resolved. Let's go to the West. Any questions on Gaza? There's not much to say, actually.
Do you see any outcome? What is going to happen?
It just seems insoluble. Well, it is soluble, but it
requires huge compromise.
It would need political will, and we don't see that happening. So I really don't know. I mean, I suspect we'll be doing reports Gaza 2025 a livable place, because of course when you say it's unlivable, all the things is that people's expectations and standards just shrink. So, you know, gas could probably take 3 million people, but it'll just be a much worse place. But the issue is that it's also a question of how long the international community is going to pay for it, because that's the only thing that's sustaining it at the moment. So, but yeah, I mean, there needs to be a political solution. And, you know, going back to the one state solution, I don't see the Israeli authorities saying, okay, let's everyone, because the one state solution is not just everyone having equal rights, it's also having the right to live anywhere within the. I don't see the Israeli authorities saying, okay, we gave it up in the two state, let's all live happily together, and by the way, you 2 million people in Gaza are welcome to come and live anywhere between the Mediterranean and the River Jordan, which is why I'm saying that whatever about the two-state solution, you can query it in many aspects and the how just it is, but it was a realistic, I think, at one stage. And you have to remember, when the Oslo Accords were broached, probably the population of Gaza was just over a million. So, yes, because it has doubled in the last 20, 25 years.
Is there any mention of a one-state solution?
By whom?
The UN.
No, the UN, as the Secretary General said, there's no plan B. And I don't know at what stage.
I mean, right now they're tinkering with pieces and crises.
Well, it's been managed at the moment. I'm not even sure it's been managed, frankly. But I don't know if the current trends continue. At some stage, it will be impossible to even pretend that there is going to be a two-state solution. And then I don't know what
a two-state solution seems awfully complex.
Well, it's not complex at all, actually.
Oh, really?
As a solution. It's very easy.
Well, geographically, it is.
The
land is not contiguous.
No, but that's why you have a link.
A connection.
And that's, it's only 40 kilometers from, even if you did it as a tunnel, from an engineering point of view, it's relatively easy. So that's not difficult at all. The logistics or the engineering of it is not difficult. It's the politics of it. But as long as Israel wants to separate the West Bank and Gaza, which they clearly do, but without having a solution to what's going to happen to Gaza, that's not going to happen. And Gaza clearly, as of itself, doesn't have any future. It's not going to survive by itself. It has to be connected with some bigger. If it's
preferably with contiguous land, there you go.
Well, you could expand it, of course. Israel could give some land, or Egypt could give some land,
yeah.
And that would obviously ease it, but that wouldn't solve it. It has to be connected to some other territory.
Right.
Now, Israel would clearly hope Egypt will do it, but Egypt's not going to do it. And nor should they do it. So Israel's not going to absorb them. So the only solution is to absorb it, to link it to the West Bank. But that doesn't seem. Israel clearly doesn't want that. So, but in of itself, there's no solution for Gaza. It has to be linked with some type of larger territory. So
does the West? I'm not particularly knowledgeable about all of this, but the West Bank itself seems to be in turmoil.
Well, this is what we look at.
All that Israel is.
Yeah, well, that's what we look at now. This is the West Bank, much larger than Gaza, 15 times the size, only 50% more population, so it shouldn't have the same. Shouldn't have the same problems with resources as Gaza's. There's no link to the sea, but of course, if there was a link to Gaza, that would allow a link by the West Bank to the sea and a port, if there was this connection.
But isn't Israel effectively moving into the West Bank?
Well, that's what we'll see. So let's look at what's happening to the West Bank, how it's being affected. First of all, we have all these settlements. And they're pretty much everywhere, as you can see, from the very top to the very tip of. You'll be down here in southern Hebron Hills. There's settlements everywhere, and that obviously physically fragments the territory. And that's just the built-up area of the settlements. So
those are all Israeli property under Israeli.
These are all Israeli towns, effectively, which have been created in the West Bank.
Have been interconnected to some extent by a.
They're all linked by roads.
Right.
Yes. So, and these are all illegal under international law. Occupying power.
They're illegal.
Illegal.
Yeah.
An occupying power is not allowed to move its population. It's not allowed to change the status of the territory.
Yeah.
You can occupy it as a result of war. That's not necessarily illegal. But if you do, you're not allowed to change the status. And you're not allowed to change it physically. And you're not allowed to change it demographically.
Of course, which has been done.
Which has become. There's now 600,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank. So it's 20% of the Palestinian population and growing faster because you've got membranes. And, of course, they're full citizens. The Palestinians are under military rule. They don't have any access to, as you'll see when you go to the... you're going to Ofir military prison, which is a joke, frankly. It's industrialized. What basically happens is, because so many people are arrested, they just do deals with the lawyer. They do plea bargains, so they all just clear the system. So we have 600,000 Israelis who get full rights, who remember the difference in the economy. The Israeli economy is 10 times the size of the Palestinian economy. So they have economic advantages. All the resources are for their benefit. And as we'll see, that's this first layer is just the built-up area. That's not the land.
The influence goes far.
Right, so that's what's built on. This is what... this is the land which is being confiscated and given to the municipalities, which is more, as you can see, particularly here, all the Jerusalem area. And then this is the land that's been confiscated and given to the regional councils. So most of the land, and this is not all, by the way, there's other layers. Most of the land in the West Bank has been expropriated using all sorts of means, laws, military order, and de facto handed over to Israel. And we don't even have the water here. It's the same water. Most water in the West Bank is for the benefit of Israel or for settlers rather than... It's not a thing. You go to settlements, you see swimming pools, and nearby you'll have Bedouin communities who are not even connected to the water network and have to pay for tankered water. So the inequality is not just... in terms, it's everything from allocation to resources to provision of services. There's total inequality. So that's the settlement. You'll hear a lot about settlements.
Well, that can't survive in the long run.
Not in the long run, but it's been 50 years now. In June, we marked...
And becoming more pervasive.
And more interconnected. It's not just... because this is just settlements. We look at other things, and they're all interconnected. So,
it sounds ultimately as if Israel will take over the West Bank.
Well, they're
integrated with.
Yeah, effectively, but there is a problem. They don't want the population, the Palestinian population. So, what do you do with three?
You're damned in either case.
Well, what you do is you take the resources and you cantonize the people, which effectively is what happened. And if the international community is paying for, which they are, then in a way you've got the best of all worlds. Where you're getting all the resources from the West Bank, but you're not paying any of the price for it. So that's settlements. Then we have the wall or the barrier, which is here, which you'll see it in Bethlehem because... there's a big wall between Bethlehem and East Jerusalem.
We see some of it coming in the last
night. Yeah,
if you came in 443, it's this road. You actually came like this. So this part you would have seen. You would have come down here.
Yeah.
You would have seen some of it. Some of it's wall and some of it's fence, but it's all interconnected. So that's also changing the landscape, as you can see. And in particular, it's cutting off farmers from their land, which is a big issue because you need permits. That's a big thing in the West Bank, permits and ID cards. Permits to come to Israel, permits to cross the wall, etc., etc. I should say that East Jerusalem has been annexed by Israel. It's not recognized by the international community, but it has been annexed. And then we have all the different... checkpoints and okay. Now we had over 500 ops. They're not all checkpoints. There's earth mounds, and we've got earth mounds and roadblocks and gates. Lots of gates on roads which can be open or closed or locked, etc., etc. So it's very physically fragmented the West Bank, as you can see. And one reason we monitor it is because, you know, as a humanitarian arm, as you can imagine, this causes problems for people getting to school or to hospitals. For example, we mentioned in East Jerusalem, all of the major hospitals for Palestinians are in East Jerusalem, the cardiac hospitals, the cancer treatment hospitals, the eye hospitals. We mentioned the problems that people from Gaza have to come to East Jerusalem. But also, if you're in Bethlehem or Ramallah, you also need a permit to come to East Jerusalem as a patient. Now, they're easier to get. In Gaza, hardly anyone gets them. In the West Bank, about 80% of people who apply get them, which is better. But it does mean 20% of people are refused. And again, in most cases, they're coming because it's the specialized hospitals. So there are hospitals in Ramallah and Bethlehem.
So what happens to that 20%?
Then they have to go to
wherever else.
I mean, there are good hospitals, but again, the best ones are in East Jerusalem, particularly, and the cardiac specialists are in East Jerusalem, etc., and the cancer ones. And the facilities are in East Jerusalem. So 20% of people are refused. That's quite a lot, if you think about it, if you're actually applying for specialized, because for most other things, you can get it in Ramallah or Nablus or Hebron. There are good hospitals there. You don't need to come to Jerusalem for normal procedures. Effectively, you are. And again, WHO monitors that. So it's better than Gaza, clearly, but it's still not anything near acceptable.
We have to leave it there as we've run out of time. You have been listening to a conversation with Ray Dolphin of the UN's Office of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Carter calling Network 23. Network 23, are you receiving me?
This is Network 23, not receiving. Intermittent loss.
Edison Carter to Network 23. Come on, guys, clear this link.
Network 23 to Edison Carter. The link is strong and clear. 2 minutes to airtime. Your controller is Garister.
Thank you, 23.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with former Sunday Times journalist Kevin Carhill and me, Tony Gosling. Why is Julian Assange still imprisoned in the Ecuadorian embassy, even though there's no charges against him from Sweden anymore? British authorities don't even want to interview him. No arrest warrant, nothing. It's just the Met. And getting away with it. 26 councillors in Devon are Freemasons, and there's no obligation on them to declare their membership, so there may well be many more. Why are so many more councillors and possibly MPs Freemasons than the rest of the population? Are they not there to work for us, but to do favours for their mates, like making sure they get planning permission, licences, that sort of thing? We have a look at Freemasonry in our present royal family, the Queen's strong but little-known connection to it, and go back to look at links to the Zionist movement, creating the State of Israel, as well as possible origins. They say it all started in 1717. But there's evidence from pre-revolutionary France that it actually began in the English Civil War. Finally, why did the outgoing chairman of the Police Federation use his final speech to attack Freemasonry within the law enforcement system and the police specifically? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. You can be sure to catch it online. This week, a full hearing from Grenfell Tower, Ground Zero. The locals are getting fed up with the lack of progress as the atrocity perpetrated on 70 people disappears from the headlines. But not on Dialect. That is Dialect at BCFM, noon next Tuesday. And I've got some shows for while we're away, as yet unaired due to technical troubles over the last few months. Download it from dialectradio.co.uk the week before broadcast. But let's start, Kevin, by having a look at some of the news stories from around the world this week. Particularly, this guy, Max Schrems, has brought a court case. Another one, actually over in Austria this time. He was famous for a while for suing Facebook successfully to get his private information back from them over in Ireland. But now he's moved his legal case over to Vienna, I believe.
Okay. The reason is dead simple. He had to bring his case in Ireland because the regulator, the EU regulator for Facebook, was in Ireland. Now, this little exercise to defend his Article 8 privacy right has cost Max 200 grand so far.
That's now, ridiculous.
This process is...
People can only challenge Facebook if they've got deep pockets, huh? Is that it?
No, this is... There's a hidden crisis. Max got a fantastic judgment in the Irish High Court. The Irish High Court found the American government guilty of mass and indiscriminate surveillance. Max won an astonishing judgment. Then he won the further judgment in the European, the highest court you can go to. But, and this is something I'm engaged in right now, neither of the judgments have been implemented by anyone. And we pay regulators and so on to implement. But Max has been left adrift by the...
So what was the point of having that High Court in Ireland case if nothing's actually happened as a result?
Well, as I say, legally, it was a huge victory. And you will find nothing in any legal journal raising this judgment. This judgment is the first time, probably historically, that a High Court judge pointed the finger at the United States government and said, you're committing criminal offences in our country and in the European Union, and so on. And he documented it.
So they just shrug their shoulders and say, so what?
Yeah, well, we've taken it further. Failing to implement the second victory that Max won in the European Court of Justice has not been implemented, and that is hugely serious. And not a single newspaper anywhere has written about it. When the judgments of the Supreme Court of Europe are ignored, then a central pillar of the EU itself is cracking.
Well, now, it certainly seems like that. But anyway, what's this? What's happened this week over in
Okay, this week, well, Max has done two things. He's launched a new website so that people can bring their own cases in their own countries. And he has started...
I guess we better put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk so you can follow what Max has been up to.
Yep. And Max is bringing a case himself in Vienna in the local court, which will cost him a fraction of what Ireland... I mean, he has wound up the defendant in Ireland, the regulator in Ireland, made Max a defendant in his own case. I mean, it gets beyond the bizarre.
Also this week, we've heard that there is quite a serious cyber threat from Russia. The UK Defence Secretary, Gavin Williamson, has said that we've really got to watch out. And Sir Nick Carter, the head of the British Army, has also been saying that we aren't really able to fight a war with Russia because our 80,000 soldiers and the state of our defences are not really good enough.
OK. This is the issue of fake news. We are back in what, at my age, I recognise as a complete Cold War propaganda war. What Williamson said is what we do to the Russians. He forgot to mention that. Nick Carter suggested we might be fighting Russia. We have 80,000 troops in uniform. The Russians have 1.1 million with reserves of 2.5 million.
We're talking about NATO altogether, not just Britain.
No, but Nick Carter spoke specifically. This was the really odd thing. He spoke specifically of the UK fighting Russia. Well, those are the odds. And I don't think... Clearly, the whole purpose of NATO, in case there's war, is to be the first line of defence. But Carter spoke in terms of the UK fighting Russia. How could we do this? Two aircraft carriers with no planes and 11-to-1 basic superiority for Russia. But the fundamental thing is that this is a propaganda war. Most of the things, neither Williamson nor Carter has raised the issue of American spying in Britain. They're talking about hacking by Russia and all this stuff. Neither of them have said a word about the American hack in Britain that affects 38 million people.
Going back to look at cybersecurity and publishing, Julian Assange's health apparently is in a dangerous condition, say doctors. Two clinicians examined him with renewed calls for him to be given safe passage to hospital. Does seem like there's a punishment here going on because Assange effectively is one of the world's most important publishers of literature, whistleblowers, this sort of thing, that challenged the establishment.
There's no mystery at all. The Attorney General of the United States has said that arresting Assange and bringing him to the United States is a priority. And clearly, that priority is being helped by the British government. You know, they kept the Met outside the door. He's facing a charge of breaching bail, but that's not exactly a major criminal offence. And the government is... The British government is utterly mad because if Julian comes out of the embassy and is snatched and the Americans are then allowed to bring charges, the United Kingdom will never be able to hold its head up again.
Now, a few things here. I mean, you know, every once in a while, surely, maybe not this time of year, but in the summer. In fact, why not even every Friday night? Assange could come out onto the balcony and give a kind of speech, couldn't he? And leak some of it. I'm sure people in London would love that. You know, they're going on, let's go and see Assange tonight. He could be giving some fascinating facts about what the Anglo-Zionist Empire is doing to the rest of the world. Yeah. He could be doing that. The other thing, of course, he could be doing is put on some sort of disguise and sneaking out of the embassy, pulling a fast one on the Met.
Haven't heard him that he has done that. He might have, but
no. But I'm suggesting. Why doesn't he at least, you know, and maybe even face the courts? Should he do that or not?
Well, I would suggest to him no. I mean, he's clearly being set up for a judicial kidnap by the British government on behalf of the American government. Now, the kidnap being arranged with the British government, by the American government. The American government is the same one that is spying in Britain and the British government's done nothing about it. The United States government commits crimes every day in this country using this spying program called PRISM. And when David Cameron tried to get President Obama to stop it, Obama refused.
But hang on, I mean, surely if you haven't done anything wrong, you've got nothing to worry about being put under surveillance.
This is stupid. The answer to that is simple. You have a right to privacy unless you are a suspect and there's material evidence against you. That's the laws, the oldest laws of England.
That's the old laws, okay, yeah, maybe medieval or something. But nowadays, these intelligence services, I mean, we're not actually talking, we're talking about the signals intelligence people, GCHQ, the National Security Agency, they're all over the place. Looking at various people's computers, maybe even switching them on and off while you're out, you know, this sort of thing.
No, it's much more specific. And GCHQ broadly are not allowed to do mass surveillance in Britain. The law has been tightened up and they have been forced into...
Well, they do what they get. They just get the Americans to do it. Sure.
Well, no, that there was the court case that was brought by Liberty and Amnesty saw the end of that. The High Court ruled...
But nobody knows what they're up to, Kevin, surely. Nobody knows whether they're doing this stuff. They're totally secret. No. They're intelligence services. They're not going to allow you or me to wander into GCHQ, have a look over somebody's shoulder and say, hang on, you shouldn't be doing that.
It's much simpler. Well, you don't have to do that. The mass surveillance that's being conducted is fully documented in public in the Irish High Court. Why has no British reporter been over there to read the evidence? You could build the whole picture, but the largest amount of surveillance, and it does cover 67% of the population, is being done by the National Security Agency, not GCHQ.
Now, so Julian Assange, he's asked the UK courts today to drop his arrest warrant. Lawyers for Assange have asked the London court to withdraw this warrant for his arrest, saying it's lost its purpose. It was issued in 2012 after he allegedly breached bail conditions. He's been facing extradition to Sweden. The Crown Prosecution Service says Mr. Assange could walk free if he succeeds. Before the start of court proceedings, Assange's lawyer, Gareth Pearce, told reporters the warrant should have no status because the proceedings in Sweden had come to an end. Earlier this month, the UK government refused to grant WikiLeaks founder any diplomatic status and called on him to leave the embassy and face justice.
The breaching bail is hardly a capital crime, but the real problem for Julian is a very simple one. The British government has set up a judicial kidnap. This is rendition by another name. The moment he comes out, an arrest warrant from the United States will turn up in the hands of the Met, who are probably already have it and who are colluding, and the Met need to think very carefully about this. Kidnapping somebody like Assange is a crime. If they're colluding with the United States to kidnap him and remove him to the United States, they are perverting the course of justice. And this is rendition by another name.
Let's have a look at another cyber story. That's over in Afghanistan. I didn't realise it, but one of the wonderful changes that's taken place since the invasion of Afghanistan by NATO back in 2011 after the 9/11 attacks in the US is that they've now got these biometric identity cards over there. The long-standing effort to distribute electronic ID cards to citizens has been marred by a dispute in Afghanistan, leading to violent street protests and walkouts in parliaments and scuffles amongst politicians. The deadlock centres on the issue of whether ethnicity should be printed in the documents. So this is biometrics. This is things like DNA, iris scans, fingerprints, all contained within within these ID cards. Now, this is the sort of thing that they were trying to do in Britain, and not necessarily exactly the same, but a similar ID card system. What are your thoughts about the move towards this? To me, it just seems totally unnecessary to have people's, identity to such an extent put in some sort of ID card system, and particularly when you're talking about things like their ethnicity or their religion, this kind of thing.
None of this.
I mean, this is exactly the sort of thing which can be used to then single out people of a particular ethnic or religious bent for persecution by a secret police or whatever. It's like, I mean, the Gestapo would have loved this kind of thing. This is Gestapo-type technology.
This is Nazi technology. The position I take is the simplest one. There are old and solid British laws to stop this kind of thing, to stop the government having every iota on you. Unfortunately, right now, another government, the American government, is doing this every day, and the British government has done nothing. So you are worried about the British government getting the mass surveillance stuff from the American government. It's possible, and it may have happened, but it is illegal. And let me add to, we have an Investigatory Powers Act, which is in effect at the moment suspended, and the European Court ruled against it. It was Tom Watson brought the case. So the pressure from the United States to get us, the United Kingdom, to put the population under mass surveillance has failed. The European Court of Justice said you can't do it. Mass surveillance is always illegal, but the purpose of mass surveillance is control. It's a tool of power. It's not a tool of justice. And all this stuff should be publicly debated. But the intellectual response to the attempts at mass surveillance of our population are totally inadequate, and the legal responses as well.
Another cyber story. Russia is saying, and responding to the one we were talking about earlier, Russia is saying that Britain's Defence Secretary's claim of an attack threat is like something from Monty Python. This is in the Daily Telegraph a couple of hours ago. Okay. Russia has dismissed a warning by Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson that Moscow could cause thousands and thousands and thousands of deaths in Britain with an attack that would cripple the UK's infrastructure and energy supplies. In an interview with The Telegraph, Gavin Williamson said Russia has been researching the UK's critical national infrastructure, how it connects to continental power supplies, with a view to creating panic and chaos. Delivering his assessment of the threat from what he calls an increasingly assertive Kremlin, he said it was willing to take action that any other nation would see as completely unacceptable. Well, what do you make of the Russian reply to what Gavin Williamson is saying? Monty Python?
Not far off, because there's a fake news issue. What Williamson didn't disclose, well, we're doing the same to Russia. We have had a surveillance program on all their overseas cables. We have got all their pipelines and everything else on maps, targeted. And Williamson is just, you know, this is pure propaganda. And insofar as it gives you half the picture, but not the other half, what we're doing, it's false. And their response, well, they should, you know, the laughing policeman, they should have turned on that record. The man is verging on the lunatic.
The Russia is ready to kill us by the thousands,
yeah,
apparently Mr. Williams has said. Official representative of the Russian Defence Ministry, Major General Igor Konashenkov, accused the Defence Secretary of losing his understanding of where the limits of common sense lie long ago. Now, this is a war of words, Kevin, but what he's really talking about here is the idea that we could be disconnected from, as individuals around the country, and factories, hospitals, that kind of thing, from the electricity supply. And I assume he's talking about some sort of hacking here.
Well, given that the United Kingdom is the daily victim of a huge hack by the United States government, that's the one we should be worrying about. But if you're military service and you're in the kind of state we're in, we, the United Kingdom, have mapped everything in Russia. We've mapped all their cables, all their oil and everything. We have positioned ourselves to do the same.
The British government has spent, by the way, £11 billion in trying to persuade us to install smart meters around the country. The Times on 13th of January had a story, smart meters may be a dumb move. Smart meters and their challenges for energy distributors. It seems that the government has actually put £11 billion behind something which could allow the Russians to completely shut down our energy supplies.
No. What they've actually done is put $11 billion into something that the American internet companies can use to do mass surveillance. The effect you talk about is secondary. We've done the same to Russia. What's the difference?
The criticisms from this is from CB CN News, New Brunswick, that's in Canada. This review about smart meters not being so smart is talking about the vulnerability of these smart meters. Why would they want us to install something which is so vulnerable that can, for example, allow, you know, your, I mean, what it does do is it allows the power company to switch your electricity off if you don't pay your bill.
That,
remotely.
Yeah, that they're allowed to do without warning and all the rest of it. And there'll be all
but you know, the Russians can come in and use that technology too. And I imagine the other way around. But I mean, what I'm trying to get at here, Kevin, is why are we installing this innately vulnerable infrastructure?
Right. We were offered at home in our house, we were offered a smart meter. So I asked the company to put in writing a guarantee that the data being picked up by the smart meter would not be fed any further on to anyone. That was about 6 weeks ago. I'm still waiting, and we've never heard from them again. So, yes, the danger is there. But the way Williamson is presenting it is Cold War propaganda. It's an unbalanced picture, and he doesn't tell anybody what we're doing.
Well, let's get back to the story about the army and potential problems with our armed forces being able to actually deal with the Russians. I suppose they're talking about maybe would they invade Scotland or somewhere like that? I don't know. But anyway, let's get back to Prime Minister's questions where this came up this week.
Andrew Bowie! Yay!
Mr. Speaker, many members on both sides of the House, myself included, have expressed concern about the future of our national defences. But of course, the fact is that this government will always take the right long-term decisions to protect our national security. So can my right honourable friend today assure this House and assuage these concerns that this approach will continue?
Prime Minister!
My honourable friend has raised a very important subject. And in July, the government initiated the National Security Capability Review, which was in support of the ongoing implementation of the 2015 National Security Strategy and Strategic Defence and Security Review, to ensure that we do indeed have the capabilities, the investment in those capabilities that we need in our national security, and that that investment, those capabilities are as effective, as joined up as possible. I've agreed the high-level findings of this review with ministerial colleagues at the National Security Council, and I've directed that the work should be finalised and with a view to publishing a report on this in late spring. But it has been a significant piece of work. It will help to ensure we have the right capabilities. As part of that, we recognise more work was needed on defence to work on modernising defence. And we want to ensure that the defence budget is being spent intelligently and efficiently, and that we're investing in the capabilities we need to keep our nation safe. And my right honourable friend, the Defence Secretary, will update the House on this in due course.
Yeah. I mean, of course, the first duty of any government, Conservative or Labour, is to defend the country. And measures to make sure we are properly defended are reasonable. But the whole debate is being polluted by this revived Cold War rhetoric, which is one-sided. Our people, the British people, are only being told half the story. And that is dangerous and it's wrong.
So what's happened to journalism over the last 30, 40 years that means that we're really not getting balanced views? Or has it just always been like that?
No, I don't think it's a conspiracy or anything. There's a vast amount of information now around the place, and there are very few journalists. I mean, in London, there are maybe 700 staff journalists in media and so on, excluding BBC. But what you've got is 3,000 or 4,000 government press officers. It's extremely hard to report properly. There isn't the time. Not many reporters have the expertise to say, ah, Mr. Williamson, what about what we are doing to the Russians? We'd like to hear more about that from you. And are we provoking Russia? And who, you know, you ask the criminal question, cui bono, who benefits? And the party who benefits most from the raising of tensions with Russia are American arms suppliers.
What bothers me is that we've been talking for decades now about regime change, demonising leaders around the world. I mean, it really You know, started on a really big way with Saddam Hussein at the time of the first Gulf War, because he wouldn't get out of the way. We wanted his oil, and so he was tricked by April Glasby to go into Kuwait. As she, the American ambassador, said, "Oh, we won't do anything. Just go and get that oil." You know, and of course, when they did, there was a big furore about it. And then, so you had Saddam. You've also had Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, a hate figure for whatever decades, actually, did an amazing job with Libya, made it one of the best countries in Africa in terms of things like infant mortality, average wealth of the individuals there, the fact that they didn't owe anything to the IMF at all. They were completely 100% debt-free as a nation. So Gaddafi was the bogeyman. Then we had Assad. Assad is now managing, it seems, to stay as the president of Syria. And I'm rather worried that what we're seeing now is, like you were talking about the Cold War, that there's actually a will to get regime change in Moscow, because that's the only place that that NATO and the Anglo-Zionist Empire can go now.
Well, the United States spends $73 billion on unexplained, you know, spy activities. Most of that is directed against Russia. And a great deal, the media are simply, you know, for the reasons I've explained rather than conspiracy, there are very few journalists and an enormous number of government press officers. And without a lot of expertise and, say, experience like I have of having gone through the Cold War and seen the demonizing of people by particularly the Tories and the right-wing American governments. It's just gameplay, and it's dangerous.
Isn't it sleight of hand as well? Because it's like, here's something to be concerned about and worry about abroad, where actually you've got people dying of cold on the streets outside your doorstep.
Yep.
Also, look, we've been talking a lot about cyber stuff, but I must mention this story because I found it absolutely riveting, although hardly any coverage in the national press. Intel's Spectre fixes. Spectre. This is James
Not
Bond.
Not a great choice of
James
name.
James Bond. Well, I think it's to fix some sort of problem with a virus called Spectre. But anyway, Intel, who make these microchips for all we all use in our computers, we've got them in the studio here, no doubt, quite a few of them, fixes are complete and utter garbage, says the Linux inventor Linus Torvald. In fact, he uses some quite expletive language to talk about it. The Linux inventor Linus Torvald has never been one for diplomacy, they say, in The Verge magazine or online. He previously said various bad things that we can't say on air here for people not supporting Linux. And now Intel has angered him enough to generate some more expletives in a message to the Linux kernel mailing list at the weekend. Torvalds expressed his dismay at Intel security updates to protect against the major Spectre variant 2 CPU vulnerability. Okay, Spectre is a vulnerability.
It's a vulnerability,
of processors. The industry has been scrambling to fix the meltdown, and Spectre vulnerabilities and the variant 2 of the Spectre has been particularly challenging. So this is where someone has discovered that actually you've hardwired into these chips ways that anyone can get under the radar through your antivirus, through your firewalls, and get straight into your directly into your microchip. But anyway, so some bright spark has discovered this, and what Intel have done is released a what they call a patch, where you install that and this is no longer vulnerable. They can't get in anymore. The only trouble is, once you install the patch, the computer either becomes totally unbootable, so you can't start it up, or else it just goes off for no apparent reason, switches itself off. Mm-hmm. So this is, I find it absolutely incredible that people working supposedly at this very high level in the high-tech world have invented a patch that actually destroys your computer. So it's almost like they're saying, well, you've got to have this vulnerability in your system, and if you don't have it, we're going to turn your computer off.
Yeah. Well, the original flaw was a design flaw in the chip itself. It's very profound, but it's quite like having a car with one of the back wheels missing, but nobody noticed because the car stayed balanced on three. But the patches are hideous, and it's not clear they even work.
So it's almost like, okay, there's lots and lots of implications of this story, really, in that you've got all the sorts of upgrades that we're told to make on our computers. You're on your phone, you know, you're constantly being told you will upgrade this, you know, some sort of little Sieg Heiling message comes up there, you know, do this or else, you know.
Yep.
And you have to do these things effectively. Otherwise, you either keep getting bothered about it or else it does it while you're not noticing.
Correct.
So these upgrades actually could be downgrades. What you could be doing is turning, you know, actually handing your, by upgrading, big inverted commas, handing your phone, your tablet, your laptop over to some, either criminal hacker or else one of the signals intelligence services or intelligence people.
Well, you can be sure that the first people to take advantage of the flaw will have been the National Security Agency and people like GCHQ. But I would trust Torvalds. If he says the patches are dreadful, then they're probably worse. So, what can you say? You're told your car is missing a wheel and you're given a new wheel to fit on it. The only trouble is the wheel has no nuts.
Okay, so I got a laptop, well, it must have been a couple of years ago now, and when I got it, it came with Windows 10. I started using it for the first few days. It started just turning off.
Yep.
It would say, you've got to update me, whatever. And you couldn't actually switch it on for whatever, something like 2 or 3 hours. It would be sitting there going round and round and round. You can't switch the damn thing on. So I thought, well, I actually don't really want this operating system. Thank you very much, Bill Gates. And I managed to find a place that would, in fact, some of the small computer shops will do this for you, will actually put a much easier to use operating system on, like Windows 7 or Linux.
Linux
actually works reasonably well. I mean, you know, it's not as if it's impossible to use. And what it does do is it means that it's quite a lot of the applications that you might want to download software that doesn't work with it, but all of the main bits of software, for example Skype, things like that, that you know I use quite a lot, you can get just simple a Linux version of it. The other thing you can do, which many people don't realize, is you can put what I call an emulator on it, right? Okay, I've learned this word, where it actually behaves like Windows.
That's right.
So you can have a Linux at the bottom and you can have kind of Windows sitting on the top of it, and then you can install your Windows program on top of that.
Yeah.
Now, it just amazes me that how everybody, almost everybody out there, I'm sure most of the people listening, will probably have either Windows 8 or Windows 10 on their computer. But actually, both of these systems it's almost like they are running your computer, not you.
Oh, no, that is, I mean, I've got Windows 10 and it was forced on my machine when I wasn't looking. I was thinking about what to do about it. And one day I switched on the machine and it was half done. No choice there. And the updates come, as you say, seek Heil. Do that. You're not given a choice. And the updates are not explained. I mean, at a common sense level, you know, you're told, switch your machine off and don't do whatever. And these updates, and you're not told what the updates are.
I mean, they're treating us like kids. Although I suppose that, you know, the idea is that, well, this is all far too complicated for you to understand.
That's...
So we'll just do it for you. Thank you very much, Bill. Also, I wanted to do something this week about Iran, because Iran is, I think, a fascinating country, completely misunderstood in many ways. Having visited it, 3 years ago or something now, found the people absolutely lovely, mostly very warm-hearted. Mm. And, of course, it's Persian culture. It's been going quite a while, a few thousand years, you know. Did things like Cyrus of Persia released the Jews from Babylonian captivity, which a lot of people forget, particularly Netanyahu seems to forget that one. And so I asked a guy who organises a conference there every year, which is happening in a few weeks' time, called the New Horizons Conference, where he invites creative people from all over the world. His name is Hamed Gashgavi. And I asked him, I said to him, look, what about women in Iran? Because the perception here in the West is that actually women are oppressed in Iran. This is what he had to tell me.
Take the example of a woman in Iran. 65% of students in Iranian universities are female. Can find the vice president, vice minister, the chancellor of universities. I mean, around the country, in the society, in private and governmental, companies, you can find women and female, I mean, everywhere. I mean, the society is much more feminist than some other European societies. But in the eyes of, you know, those ministry media in West, if we don't have that new slavery market, which is pornographic market in Europe, in east of Europe, in west of Europe, in north of Europe. So because we don't have that, it means that we are against women. We are against so-called liberation of women, which is, I mean, Professor E. Michael Jones authored that book entitled Sexual Liberation and Political Control. In 400 pages, he explained how that, I mean, politically control is related to sexually liberate people. So if tomorrow Iran will say, okay, you're going to obey to those American government and you'll be like other puppets in the Middle East, so you will never, ever, never hear anything bad about Iran in Western media. And that's because actually they are looking for the interests. I mean, in Iraq and in Afghanistan, you see how that's American democracy by force. You know, they have invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, that war on terror after 9/11 they have started. So you see how actually they have been destroying people. I mean, that democracy and freedom by force, the French comedian Dieudonné has been saying that Americans arrive in Iraq, they ask people, do you have a democracy? The people say, no, they don't have democracy. Okay, we'll put democracy by force in your mouth. Okay, you have to accept it. We would like to bring freedom and democracy. And you see the result after 10 years in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in Sudan, in other countries. I mean, everywhere there is a chaos.
Yeah, this is. But how is it? It's done by working up a propaganda war in the West and demonizing. This is what he's talking about. Iran is totally misrepresented. Iran has an enormous, or Persia as it was, made an enormous contribution to science and mathematics, which are very important over the centuries. And this is all ignored.
What about this this week, the big scandal, the President's Club? We could have talked about that in the first hour, I suppose.
Wonderful.
But, you know, it makes me wonder. I mean, a lot of the girls who were getting involved in that knew what they were getting involved in. Effectively, there is an enormous prostitute market in London, which is going on all the time, and in fact all over the world, really. Not so, I don't know about in Iran. I think they kind of stopped it over there. But this is normal in Bristol, in London. I mean, am I exaggerating to say that it was a bit of a moral panic about this event? I'm not saying it was right, but that prostitution and sexual exploitation is normal in many parts of London.
This is one of the problems. When it's normal at that level, you know, the Dorchester and the big charity and all the rest of it, it's wrong anyway. You know, if somebody wants to be a sex worker, fine. But people shouldn't be forced into it. And if they don't want to go along with it, they shouldn't be forced to.
Well, I mean, surely many of the people are trafficked into Britain to be sex workers. I noticed there was a story up in Hull recently where it was either the bishop or a canon up there was saying, well, actually, some of these caravan parks are just simply being used
by big brothels.
Well, it's effectively gangsters bringing people into women into the country and then using these caravan parks for as brothels.
No, I mean, there is a problem, but to go back to the problem with the Dorchester and the President's Club and the charity was that exploitation of a lot of those girls who went would have been poor. They'd have needed a few quid.
Well, there's another aspect to it.
A lot of them didn't volunteer to be pawed and groped.
No, and there's another aspect to it, and that is the completely stalled Alexis J. run VIP defile, National Inquiry into Sexual Abuse of Children. Now, here we're talking about accusations against senior conservatives, senior army officers, of actually murdering, and including intelligence people as well from MI6, intelligence people actually killing children to stop them testifying against them after having sexually abused them. It just seems to me that there's no interest in this inquiry anymore, and the whole thing has been kicked into the long grass. And yet we've got lots of stories of these kind of, you know, you put your hand on my knee, low-level sexual abuse, and that the really serious stuff, the serious criminal stuff, which people should go away if they're, you know, they should be going away for life for, you know, sexual abuse of children and murdering, is being forgotten about.
Well, it's been institutionalised. It's worse. There is the inquiry, but nobody's reporting it. Well, The Guardian does, but the point you're making is valid. But the thing about the Dorchester and the President's Club is it was low-level abuse at a very high level in society. in the people who should be have been setting the agenda and making sure that paedophilia, which is a huge problem, is dealt with, were, you know, abusers themselves, because they got people behind closed doors. And I thought it was a wonderful piece of journalism. Sorry about that.
Well, what I'm saying is, I think, you know, you've got to have at the same time, you've got to have it in the context of this much bigger and more important inquiry, which seems to have been, I mean, it was started by Theresa May, what was it, nearly 4 years ago now, and yet we seem to have got absolutely nowhere with it. And the woman who's in charge of it is really, it seems to me, only in her job, because when she was in Rotherham, she didn't find any. She's the fourth one. A bit like the Diana inquest, isn't it? No one actually wanted to do it, or they were kicked out if they were going to do it properly. Yeah. So, you know, there are all sorts of, well, there's all sorts of problems with that particular inquiry. She made sure that none of the police, none of the social workers, etc. in Rotherham faced jail or whatever from the inquiry. And so it seems to me, because of that, that she's been put in charge of that.
She did. The Guardian interviewed her last week. She's providing no leadership. She should never have been given this job, but you've given the specific reasons why she shouldn't have had it.
Now, there's all sorts of a couple of events that are going on next week. I should have really talked about this in the first hour. We were so enthused by Thangam that we didn't. One is called, this is next Saturday. It's after one away. It's on the 3rd of February, 7:30 at the Ark Bar, 27 Broad Street, BS1, 2HG. It's called The Lynching by Jackie Walker. To oppose Israel, she says, is not to be anti-Semitic. Well, Jackie Walker is a member of Momentum that was suspended from the party for saying that that Jews were involved in the slave trade, at the beginning of the slave trade. Now, she herself is Jewish.
Yeah, picking up tutelage from the Americans, the current right-wing government in Israel, it's a standard tactic. You make any criticism of Israel and you're anti-Semitic. You know, there's no no way to make a choice.
I spoke to Jackie a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. It's on one of our dialects from a couple of weeks ago. So let's have a listen to a clip from that now.
Well, no, there's partisan reporting, isn't there? There's definitely partisan reporting. I remember
she's talking about
I had
on Israel.
You once with the BBC, and she said to me off the record. Of course, she said to me off the record, I have to tell you what happened. Is if we report anything about Israel and we do that in any kind of way, which is a negative, before that program has finished, there will be hundreds of complaints, official complaints made against us. And so there's a barrage. You know, any media receive a barrage of criticism, all that has to be followed up. So I think in part there's that. And I also think it's just, you know, we are part of the American empire. The American empire has decided it's within their interest to back Israel and to condemn Iran. And we are party to that, and our media is also party to that.
Well, they're free to do that, aren't they?
Yes, they're free to do that, and we're free to point that out, or we should be free to have that pointed out without being accused of being racist.
Okay, Jackie, could you just tell us, give us one reason why we should come along and see your play?
Because you really enjoy it. It's actually, I mean, you know, Alexei Sale, who wrote a review in The Observer, said he initially came because he thought it was a duty, and he ended up just saying it was his choice for theatre for the Sunday Observer because he enjoyed it so much.
And it's on at the Palestine Museum on Broad Street on Saturday the 3rd of February at 7:30. And amazingly, if you come a little bit early, there's some food too. I imagine from the region at 6 p.m. they're doing food.
That's right. That's right. That's it.
Anyway, how do people follow your case online or in the newspapers, Jackie?
Well, they can have a look at my Facebook page, which is, I've got a couple of Facebook pages. One is called just Jackie Walker. The other one is called Jacqueline Walker, you know, and they are reasonably open. That makes it kind of difficult for me at times. But I'm pretty sure that when my case comes up in front of the Labour Party, as, for example, the Jewish Chronicle and the Board of Deputies have been sort of baying for me to be excluded from the Labour Party, I'm sure that it will be in newspapers and reported in the media.
Is there any kind of Jewish lobby in London that you would say is more balanced on Palestine, and where you can get both sides?
Oh yeah, of course there is. You know, there's a Jewish Voice for Labour, for example. There's Free Speech on Israel, which is not a totally Jewish group, but has many Jews in it. There's Labour Against the Witch Hunt. These organisations are all organisations which are either significantly Jewish, or in terms of Jewish Voice for Labour, they are actually totally Jewish. And then there's the Jewish Socialist groups. There's Jews for Justice for Palestinians. There are many Jewish groups that see what's happening in Israel as something that needs to be challenged.
Now, this witch hunt, I mean, that's a fairly strong term to use. Would you see it as that as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, what a witch hunt means is that a series of smears are set up against people who are innocent, and they are excluded and victimised. And that is certainly what's happened to me and a number of my comrades.
Well, when Who Owns the World came out, the Israeli ambassador wrote to me and said I should have the book pulped because I had said Tel Aviv is the capital of Israel. And he said, no, it wasn't. Jerusalem was. So he set himself up. I said, well, when the government of my country decides that Jerusalem is the capital, I'll follow my government.
And also, as promised, Steve Norman's funeral, just to announce where and when that's taking place. Of course, we had John Langley talking about Steve, and Steve was helping me with a report that I did back in November here on the radio. Steve Norman's funeral, he also worked very closely with the Bristolian paper, at South Bristol Crematorium, 9:30 on Friday, the 2nd of February. That's the day before the lynching is on. Followed by a wake at the Cabbage Patch Club, Lawrence Weston, BS11OST.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Right, on to our little look at the Masons, Kevin. And I know you relish this because you actually met a few Freemasons. I think you almost try and almost pretend to be one sometimes, don't you?
No, I don't. But one time I was in Zurich and I met the Grand Master and he showed me around the principal lodge in Zurich. In Zurich, there are 7 Freemason lodges. There's a Jewish lodge and a Catholic lodge and 5, you know, for piebalds. But I asked him, you know, what's the history of Freemasonry? And he said, oh, it was started in the 18th century. And I said, well, it doesn't look like that to me. And he said, well, actually, we are descended from the alchemists, and I quote you, he said, they had a bad press, so we don't like to raise the issue.
Who were the alchemists?
The alchemists were, in effect, the people who kept the idea of science going through the Dark Ages. They were trying to change lead into gold.
Did they get a bad press? How did they get a bad press?
Because they were reckoned to be magicians, and the Catholic Church didn't like competition.
Did they just not like science, the Catholic Church?
No, they didn't like competition.
Well, the main reason we're talking about the Freemasons, actually, although there is this brilliant report out from Devon about all the Masonic councillors down there, is that Steve White, who's stepping down as the chair of the Police Federation, says that the Freemasons are threatening progress of women and black minority ethnic people, and they're blocking reform in the police service. Reform in policing is being blocked by the Freemasons, and their influence in the service is thwarting the progress of women and people from black minority ethnic communities, the leader of rank and file officers has said. Steve White, who stepped down in December after 3 years as chair of the Police Federation, he told The Guardian he was concerned about the continued influence of the Masons.
Yeah, I mean, it's a secret society, despite pretensions to be open nowadays. it's to benefit its members first. And no civilized societies like ours should have groups belonging to a secret society involved in a very powerful and important things like parliament, like the police, like the military, but it's less so in the military.
Also, there's been quite a lot in the press, at least in the Times, not elsewhere in the press, about the mafia in Italy joining Freemasons to do deals with the judiciary. Now, this sounds really pernicious. And also, just last week, Italy clamping down on the Masons after links with the mafia were exposed. So the Times is saying that strong links between Italy's secretive Freemasons and the Mafia have been exposed by police raids, with 193 crime bosses found to be members of lodges in Calabria and Sicily. Investigation confirmed long-standing accusations by magistrates and mob turncoats that Masonic lodges in southern Italy are venues for secret deals with corrupt judges, politicians and business owners. Now, one would have thought that any organisation that can allow that kind of thing would be, you'd have to register as a member of it if you were going to be a politician, but no. Anyway, I thought we'd look a little bit at some of the history of Freemasonry. For a start, there was two reports done by the Metropolitan Police into Freemasonry, Operation Tiberius and Project Riverside, and an article by Tom Harper in The Independent revealing how gangs used Freemasons to corrupt police. So Freemasonry is used really as a vector to get inside, for example, CID offices, effectively delete. It's one of the things that they say in the article. You turn up on a Monday morning and the stuff that you've done on the computer has just all been deleted. So the police investigations are thwarted that way. But officially, the Freemasons started in 1717. There's also, though, in the rituals, lots to do with the rebuilding of Solomon's Temple, which sounds bizarre. It almost seems to fit with the whole Zionist project, Kevin.
Well, the mythology of Freemasonry is firmly, it's absolutely centred on the Temple of Solomon and the first architect, Hiram Abiff. So how do you fill in the gap? What happened in between? All through history, there have been master Masons at all the big building sites, churches, hospitals and all that sort of stuff. And clearly they always got together. That's how they ran the trade.
Also, well, so worth looking at ancient. Some of the royal family. I mean, March 2013, the Queen was discovered to have a Masonic nurse. Even though apparently the Masonic hospital had been closed down in 1922, a photograph of the nurse who had been nursing the Queen had a Masonic symbol and a witchcraft symbol belt from the Royal Masonic Hospital, even though it wasn't supposed to exist anymore. That was in March 2013, so I'll put some links up to that on our show page. And also the nurse, Jacintha Saldana, she took a prank call impersonating the Queen and she was committed suicide in December 2012. Also at this so-called non-Masonic Edward VIII Hospital. Sorry, Edward VII Hospital. The Bilderberg conferences I look into, both Andrew Palmer, who was one of the organisers of a British conference, he was a senior PA to the Duke of Kent, the world's number one Freemason, and Joseph Rettinger was also a Mason who founded the Bilderberg conferences. Edward VII, Edward VIII, the Nazi one, and George VI, who was a king during the war, they were all Freemasons. You can find pictures of them online with their cute little aprons on. Also, going back, Ataturk, who dissolved the Ottoman Empire in 1922, he was a Freemason, and I'll put some links to that as well on our show page, although the Turkish government don't like to admit it. Then you've got, going right back to 1648, because this is one of the things I discovered over Christmas, is that there's a French pamphlet by someone called the Abbé Laridan, who was saying that in order to assassinate or get the death warrant signed for Charles I, Oliver Cromwell formed Britain's first Masonic lodge back in 1648, because he knew that if he didn't manage to get this all through Parliament and voted through and get a death warrant signed for the King, that he would get the chop himself.
This was power politics. I think the Masonic, that story is interesting and I suspect may very well be true, but I think there were Masonic lodges in Britain long before that.
Could well be. Anyway, I'll put a picture of Oliver Cromwell between his twin pillars up on our show page. And some links to the history of the Masons. And this, I find is incredible, is that nobody seems to make the link between Zionism and the Masons, because it's all the rituals are all to do with rebuilding Solomon's Temple, which, of course, the Zionist project is one of their key aims as well. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7, coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, MP for Bristol West, Thankham Debonair. Also to former Sunday Times Richlist journalist, author of Herons Britain, Kevin Carhill. Hopefully Martin will be back with Billy Quain an hour later, starting at 6 next week. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon. This show's story links and comment page, thisweek.org.uk.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our debts, our incomes, those of our children, and those looming down the road. And boy, are they looming after the United States Senate passed an absolutely remarkable tax bill this last few weeks, if indeed it took that many weeks. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and that in a way has prepared me to provide these economic updates to cover the events of the recent past and put them in some sort of perspective. I want to begin with a struggle going on in the United Kingdom. It pits, on the one hand, one of the largest banks in the world, Morgan Stanley, based in New York, but a global bank, like the monster banks of today usually are, and an up-and-coming political leader in Great Britain named Jeremy Corbyn. This struggle has been unfolding for a while, but really hit fever pitch a few weeks ago, and the ramifications are still gurgling around, which is why I want to talk to you about them. Here's how it began. Morgan Stanley sends communications to its banking clients and recently sent a communication saying that people should not just be very worried about Brexit, that's the process by which Britain is leaving the European Union that it was part of, that people know all about, but that the clients of the bank should be just as worried because an equivalent risk is posed by a government led by the Labour Party, whose leader is Jeremy Corbyn. Mr. Corbyn did not wait very long to respond, and he reacted by reminding the people of Britain what he thought, and indeed what many of them think, of Morgan Stanley. Let me quote Mr. Corbyn to you. Quote, "Speculators and gamblers who crashed our economy in 2008. He continues with the following quote. "Nurses, teachers, shop workers, builders, just about everyone is finding it harder to get by while Morgan Stanley's CEO paid himself £21.5 million last year." It'd be more than that in dollars. "And UK banks paid out £15 billion in bonuses." "You are right to feel threatened," Mr. Corbyn told the bank. "We are going to change things. You are not going to be taking advantage of the British people in the future, the way you have with the Conservatives in the past." That was his message. I find it remarkable for two reasons. One, we don't see that from the opposition in the United States, the Democratic Party's leaders, with the exception of Bernie Sanders, have been notably quiet when it comes to criticizing the banks, and never in language even vaguely like Mr. Corbyn's. But there's a second issue here that's even more important. The conventional excuse given by politicians as to why they don't criticize the banks, for example, in the manner of Mr. Corbyn, has been the following. If we were to criticize them, and even more if we were to tax them what we ought to, regulate them, as we ought to, why then they'll just leave, and we'll all be worse off. What a convenient excuse. I would guess it was written in the boardroom of a bank by a hired PR executive. Why? Because the threat is phony and empty. And let me explain why. In a game of threats between a bank and a country, it's the bank that has to worry. Let's suppose a government passes a tax on a bank. And let's suppose it's the American government and the bank is Morgan Stanley, an American-based bank, and it were actually to proceed to leave. Does that mean the government has no counter-threat? That the government has no steps it can take, either to prevent or to punish? A bank that leaves the country to evade a legally imposed tax? And the answer is, of course, it has weapons. Imagine a president who went to the people and the businesses of America and said, I suggest you don't patronize a bank that behaves in this asocial way. Imagine a president or a Congress which began to look into all the things that bank has been and is currently doing to ascertain where, when, and how it violates the law with an attentiveness you don't normally see. Does the bank really wish to engage these kinds of risks? Might a government decide not to do business with any company that is in turn doing business with a bank that behaves that way? The American government has done that before to other entities around the world. Why stop there? In other words, a bank that threatens the government when the government is doing its legally entitled taxing and regulating activities, a bank that threatens to leave can and should provoke in a government counter threats, counter steps. That's what Mr. Corbyn is suggesting. It's a mystery to me, but not really, why American politicians can't and won't say things like this, which would level the playing field and stop leading our politicians to be such easy pushovers for lame, empty excuses to allow the super rich to continue to get their favoritism. My next update is about inequality in the United States. Well, I'm not going to go over the statistics. I've done that in earlier programs, and I assume many of you know how grossly unequal the income and wealth distributions of the United States have become. The extraordinary wealth of the top 5 or 10% and the economic difficulties surrounding everybody else. But I wanted to bring to your attention one of the consequences of this kind of inequality. It leads businesses to go where the money is. That is, businesses that serve your average person, your poor or working class or middle person, those are the businesses that are having trouble. As in the 6,500 malls that will close in 2017 because they can't sell enough stuff. But of course, the capital that is not invested anymore in producing for the mass of people who can't buy is now finding profit by producing for the tiny number who can. Here are three examples I've found to bring to your attention. The 2019 Corvette ZR1 convertible. Don't get too excited, but let me tell you about it. It has a 755 horsepower LT5 6.2 liter supercharged engine. For those of you that are planning to do the kind of driving that requires 755 horsepower. But there it is. I wanted you to know about it. And the ZR1 convertible will start at $123,995. They will both be going on sale in the spring of 2018. Can you wait? The next automobile that caught my attention when I got on a roll with this was the Land Rover. This is the 218 Range Rover SV Autobiography SUV. It's getting a real mouthful to describe these cars. Well, this one comes with a 557-horsepower supercharged V8 engine, and it starts at just under $210,000 for this little item. And the last one, for those of you with a charming Christmas present, perhaps, on your mind, the Porsche Panamera Turbo SE Hybrid is the world's most powerful luxury sedan. How do I know that? Because they say so. This hatchback sedan gets 680 total horsepower, more than the 911 GT3 and the Cayenne Turbo SUV. I hope these letters mean something to you. They don't to me. I'm just reading it off. $188,000 will get you that one. Some people have it, and then the rest of us read about it. Then my eyes were caught by yet another milestone. The New York Times, which is read around the world as what we call the newspaper of record for the United States, sort of like the Le Monde is in France, or Die Zeit in Germany, or Toronto Globe and Mail in Canada, and so on. The kind of the newspaper that kind of represents the country. So when a newspaper with that kind of a position makes a big step, it's worth talking about. What's the step that the New York Times recently took? It's going to cut access, electronic access through the internet, to stories in the newspaper, free access from 10 stories a month to 5. If you want to read more than 5 stories a month in this daily newspaper, you will have to pay. In other words, the distribution of the news from the newspaper of record of the United States of America is going to be cut back to interested people around the world in order for the newspaper company to make more money. If you needed an example of the subordination of the distribution of information, which is the only way a community can govern itself in a rational way, the subordination of information distribution to profit, there it is. Think about it. The next update has to do with Mr. Jerome Powell. He is the new head of the Federal Reserve, the institution of the United States government whose job is to manage the monetary system, to control the quantity of money in circulation, at least as far as it can, to shape the pattern of interest rates, and thereby to shape the economic life of the United States. He said something so astonishing the other day that I want to report it to you and compare it to something said by a predecessor head of the Federal Reserve, whose name you may remember, Ben Bernanke by name, who was the head of the Fed for quite a few years before Janet Yellen took that position. Here's what Mr. Powell, the new head of the Fed, said that caught my attention. "We no longer have here in the United States," he said, "any banks that are, quote, too big to fail." Let me remind you that in the collapse of the American banking system in 2008, the lead into the catastrophe was taken by the biggest banks in the United States, who went to the federal government. I'm talking about Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Citibank, Morgan Stanley. You know them. Their names are well known. These banks went to the government, particularly in the last 4 months of 2008, and basically made the following argument. We are bankrupt. We are about to fail. Which means we are about to tell the depositors who've put their money in our bank, individuals and businesses alike, that we can't give them access to their money because we don't have it anymore. We invested it and loaned it in ways we cannot recover. And if we declare bankruptcy, all of these individuals and all of these businesses will in turn, by not having access to their money, be unable to pay their bills, plunging everybody they owe money to into the same catastrophe. You, the government, said these bankers, can't let this happen. Why? Because we, the bankers said, are too big to fail. If you let us fail, we'll take the whole system down with us. Talk about threats. And dutifully, the Department of the Treasury and the government and the Federal Reserve at that time caved in and bailed them all out. Since that time, most of those banks, get ready now, have gotten bigger than they were then. But the new head of the Federal Reserve isn't worried at all. In his judgment, we don't have banks anymore that are too big to fail. If you believe that, friends and neighbors, then let me remind you of a famous statement made by the then head of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke. In May 2007, that's just before the capitalist system crashed, led by the banks, Mr. Bernanke publicly made the following statement. Quote, "We do not expect significant spillovers from the subprime market to the rest of the economy or to the financial system." In May 2007, to remind you, millions of Americans were unable to cover their mortgage payments, which plunged millions of banks into trouble because they had made these mortgage loans to these Americans. And there was Mr. Bernanke explaining to anyone who would listen, yes, it's unfortunate for the mortgage market. It's unfortunate for those people. It's unfortunate for the banks who lend to them. But let me quote again. We do not expect significant spillovers from the subprime market to the rest of the economy. He was as wrong can be. And that's the case with Mr. Powell, likely, too. Before moving on, let me remind you that we maintain two websites that are full of information and capabilities that I think will interest you. The first is rdwolf with two Fs.com, and the second is democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. These two websites allow you to communicate to us what you like and don't like about the program, what you would like us to cover. These two websites allow you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. They provide information, linkages, and a blog that you may find interesting. Material that we upload every day to expand the reach of the work we do, but also to enable you to be partners with us, for you to make use of this information in your conversations with friends, neighbors, relatives, coworkers. We want to reach as many people as possible, and partnering with you by means of these websites is a way for us to do that. And for those of you that are listening on the radio, if you would like to see this program as a television program, there's an easy way for you to do that. Visit Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com/Economic Update, the name of the program, and you can watch this program on television in that way. Returning to our economic updates, I was struck by another act of Congress recently. You know, businesses have been trying, and successfully for many years, to prevent the people they harm with a bad product, with a misleading advertisement, in any of the ways that business harms the public and its customers. It used to be possible for individuals to begin a lawsuit to compensate themselves for the damage they've suffered, and to make that something called a class action suit, a legal form in which all the people who are victimized by a company can together sue for compensation and to get the company to stop this behavior. Companies didn't like that. Surprise, surprise. So they developed a very interesting gambit. In tiny print towards the end of contracts and public relations about what they do, they carry a little demand that anybody with a complaint about something they've done cannot go the route of a class action suit, has to go to binding arbitration. That requires individuals to pay the high costs of a lawyer to fight it out in an arbitration, and allows the company, with its deep pockets, to have a much more expensive law firm, and you can see what's going on here. And there had been action by aggrieved public and aggrieved customers to get a law that prevents companies from being able to get around the legal resource and recourse that people have. And a law had been passed. But with a new Congress and the power of the money that buys, particularly Republicans, but Democrats too in the main, the Congress undid that law. So now companies are free to require binding arbitration, which vast numbers of people cannot and will not afford, and not the success that class action suits always, or at least often, had. This leads to a general understanding. Regulating capitalism is a thankless, long-term failure as a strategy. Why? Because the people who are aggrieved by the behavior of corporations, particularly big ones, who get a regulation, don't understand that the minute that regulation is passed, after momentous opposition by the companies, they then go to work to undo the regulation, to amend it, to change it, and they have the money and they have the incentive to keep at it in the way that the aggrieved public doesn't. It's an unfair setup. It's only then a matter of time before the regulation is eviscerated, destroyed, the abusive behavior by the company resumes, the victimization of the public, of the employees, of the customers become so outrageous that they rise up and, oh no, pass another regulation. And that repeats the whole game. Eventually, people have to learn the problem is the system. Regulating it doesn't solve that problem. So long as we let businesses that do the production of the goods and services we need be run by people whose first priority, whose bottom line is their profit, whenever there's a clash between that and what we the public or we the employees need, you know as well as I do what gets sacrificed and what gets the priority. Regulation can't solve the problem. The last update we have time for comes from Italy, and indeed from Sicily, the southernmost part of Italy, and has to do with oil companies and something they have done for years. In this case, the oil company is Eni. It's the largest oil company in Italy. And it has run an oil refinery in Gela, G-E-L-A, in Sicily, for 54 years. For the last 10 years, there's been a battle between the government of Sicily and Eni. Why? Because it turns out that the Eni oil company dumped huge amounts of toxic waste in a 3-mile-long undersea dump off Sicily, close to Gela, where hundreds of people over the last decades have had an unusual kind of illness, actually a set of different illnesses, trying every which way to figure out what it was, where it came from. And they have now persuaded scientists and others to look into it, with the result that I'm reporting to you. The problem is that secretly, unknown to the people there, for decades, an oil company dumped toxic waste under the water off of Sicily. When you hear about these stories, please remember one key fact, whatever other horror this brings up when you imagine what's going on. This company did what companies in general do. It was stuck with a toxic byproduct of whatever it was producing, in this case, oil. Now it had to do something with this toxic byproduct. It could have tried all manner of chemical and other procedures to make it not toxic. Failing that, it could have tried to find safe places far away from human beings to encase this toxic material so it doesn't hurt anybody. Those kinds of efforts are expensive over long periods of time, if you can even find them. They didn't want to spend the money. They wanted to be more profitable, and had they spent the money, it would have increased their costs. The people running this oil company are not monsters. They're not all that different from you and me. They're not the problem. A system that works this way is. Imagine an oil company run by the people who are its customers, who need the oil to run their vehicles, to heat their homes, to run their businesses. Suppose the workers and the customers together ran such a business. Would they have made themselves sick in this way, or might they have found a better way? If you answer a better way, you've become a critic of capitalism, too. Thanks for paying attention. Please stay with us. We will be back after a very short intermission.
Precious nails. Flown on, she's given her own neighborhood. I'm sure she'll make a few friends. Even the rainbow's done with a spray as you cock up, cock your name. I don't know why.
they celebrate your top 10 in the charts of pain. Shock me sane. No cigarettes, only beer Havanas for you.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of this edition of Economic Update. I'm very pleased and glad to welcome to this program at this time David Jetty. He's a writer and social finance activist from Los Angeles. He began his career as co-founder of the nonprofit artist cooperative Brimmer Street. After that, he moved to the world of tech finance and asset management, and now he works as a legislative director for Public Bank LA, a movement to establish a People's Bank of Los Angeles. And that's why he's here with us today. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's start by definitions. What is public banking? How is it different from the private banks that we in America are mostly used to? What's all of this about that you are engaged in promoting and developing?
Right, well, everybody is familiar with the idea of a private bank. It's a private institution owned by private shareholders, takes deposits, and it makes loans. That's the most basic function of a bank. A public bank is really not that different. The main difference is for whom, right? The public bank is owned by the public, usually a municipal or state entity, and as a result, it makes loans with a slightly different set of priorities, usually a social mission built into its charter or exercised by its board of governors and its executives. They operate as profit-seeking entities like any other bank would. They seek to make a return on their investments and to recover principal. But the big difference is that, you know, you're not talking about trying to maximize shareholder returns quarter to quarter. You're talking about an institution that is owned entirely, let's say, by the city of Los Angeles and inures to the benefit of that city.
So the profits, for example, that a public bank would earn go into the budget of the city that owns and operates the bank rather than into private individuals' personal income.
Right, yes. The Board of Governors would decide, you know, how dividends are paid, whether they're recapitalized into the bank to expand its lending capacity, or if those dividends are paid back into the city budget.
Okay. Or it might also, if I understand, it might be committed to some sort of social mission or public project, and it might use the profits of the bank for that sort of thing, too?
Yes, yes. So,
to help build a school or expand a highway or whatever else the city that owns it or the state that owns and operates it would designate as a useful function.
Exactly. Most public banks are founded with a social mission of some kind. And that is to say that they serve a constituency rather than shareholders, a local population. At a municipal level, you're talking about financing loans for affordable housing, for infrastructure projects, transportation, student loans, agriculture loans, emergency funding, those kinds of lines of credit that cities will tend to need now and then. Right now, they would usually issue a bond or they'll keep a rainy day fund. A bank can extend that kind of credit. But the most important thing to understand here is that municipalities already use banks, right? They already keep their money somewhere. Los Angeles, for example, and I'll use Los Angeles as an example quite a bit, they have about $8 billion in a rolling credit, in a rolling checking accounts. Among all of its operational accounts across the airports, the DWP, which is water and power, and all of the taxes it collects, it keeps about that much money in commercial banks. It earns next to zero interest on that balance. In fact, it pays about $100 million in fees every year, in origination fees, wire fees, and servicing fees.
To those private banks.
That's right. That's money that is coming out of tax dollars and then going to the banks to service this banking activity. Of course, it does cost money to bank, right? These services are not free, and just creating a public bank doesn't eliminate that. But the most important thing to to realize is that deposit bank, that those deposits from the city enable the banks to lend more, right? So banks can lend at a scale relative to how many deposits they take in. Deposit is like a loan that the bank is taking out with their depositor. So you walk into a bank and you deposit $100. The bank now has your $100. Theoretically, they're supposed to pay an interest on that account, let's say 1%, which is much higher than the actual accounts pay right now. But theoretically, you give them $100, and then later you'll get back $101. That's a loan. Yeah. So what banks are doing is they borrow from their depositors, and then they go out and they lend to other people at a higher interest rate, and they make that arbitrage. Mm-hmm. The city, by keeping its money in a bank, is lending that money to that bank at zero interest. Mm-hmm. So our proposition, and we can point to many models throughout the world and in the United States, is that we stop lending that money to banks at zero interest, and we start lending it to ourselves. We can take that very large deposit base, capitalize the bank with some equity, and start to lend to projects within our own region to make sure that that money isn't extracted by Wall Street firms and reinvested all over the world in high-yield, higher-risk speculative investments, but are put to work in loans and projects that directly benefit the voters whose money it is in the first place. It also gives the city a special advantage. Banks can borrow from the Federal Reserve, I believe, at about 0.4% right now. That's the reserve rate. And that power allows them to have liquidity, and it allows them to leverage that interest rate and, again, go out and lend to other people. When a city borrows, it does so at the bond rate, right? Most city borrowing is done through bonds. They pay an upfront origination fee, and bond rates can be between 3, 5, sometimes 7%, depends on how good the credit of your city is. And you're, of course, selling these bonds to private investors. So once again, you're borrowing from people, usually very high-income households and institutions, for the privilege of developing your city, right, of getting that capital. This is despite the fact that the city itself has a rotating capital fund, which the bank is lending against. So what we're proposing is that instead of cities borrowing at the bond rate while lending all this money to banks for free, that we set up an independent institution that's run on behalf of taxpayers that can take city and county deposits, make loans within the city, borrow from the Federal Reserve at a 0.4% interest rate, which will lower costs across the board for infrastructure, all kinds of city services right off the bat, and then take that capital income from public money and put it back into the region and into taxpayers' pockets.
So your argument basically is that this is better for the citizens, say, of Los Angeles or any community, than relying on the private banks. It holds on to more of the public money and puts it to better uses that will advantage the community than if they use the private system.
Yes. We've already seen how fragile the financial system can be. In Los Angeles, we've just seen the city council put out a request for proposals for banking services, and they disqualified banks that did not receive a satisfactory CRA, right, a credit rating, or a customer, basically a good boy rating. Wells Fargo, for example, was, I think they settled that account, or at least they were charged with fraud over their cross-selling scandal.
Right.
So that actually disqualified them from providing services to the city. So the city is going to have to find another bank to put that money in. In an era of consolidation, when banks are being, concentrated more and more, a city that cares about where its money is stored will run out of options eventually. You will run out of banks that have not committed fraud.
Would be hard to do these days, given money laundering, the LIBOR scandal, the mortgage collapse, the charging of fees that are not legitimate. I mean, almost every major thing that a bank can do that's either unethical or illegal, the big ones in this country have been found to be doing. Seems to me that a large city like Los Angeles may really have, if it's going to be true to the notion of not doing business with a institution that has failed to live up to decent standards,
yeah,
that the public bank may have no competitors if it gets established.
So you do see large cities like this have some leverage. They can make demands of banks, but in general, the banks don't follow through. And I mean, and we're talking about fraud, right? We're talking about market fixing, those kinds of things. But there's plenty of other things that banks are involved in that most taxpayers, most voters are not for, investing in fossil fuels and the development of new energy, like through energy transfer partners at the Dakota Access Pipeline, right? Wells Fargo was intimately part of that investment. And that actually sparked a big divestment movement in L.A. that actually birthed the Public Bank L.A. organization that I'm a part of, where people didn't want to help finance these projects, which, you know, destroy the environment, and they extract value from the environment and workers.
So the public, in a public bank, the public could, through its votes and so on, influence what is done with its own money, whereas if you deposit it in a private bank, it becomes the private bank that decides where the loans go and not. So the private bank is responsible to its shareholders in some sense, the public bank to the public. Would this be reasonable then to say that the public bank is a more democratic institution, basically?
Oh, absolutely. Because your average public bank is governed by political appointees or elected officials. And insofar as you will vote for those individuals or the people who appoint them, it's considerably more democratic than Goldman Sachs or Wells Fargo, which theoretically the stockholders elect, but there's only a handful of major shareholders that really make those decisions.
Okay, one of the things that I know is in the minds of people listening and watching this program is the following. Is the idea of a public bank a fantasy, a utopian dream, something in the distant future? Or is it something that exists in the world today, exists perhaps in the United States today, something we can point to and say we already have an example, a history, an empirical record of what's been going on?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is a rhetorical question. You know, and I know that the answer is yes, we have examples. So let's start with the one here in the United States that gets all the attention once you learn about this, which is the Bank of North Dakota. Tell us a little bit about it.
Right. So the Bank of North Dakota is the only currently operating public bank in the United States. It's very successful. It was founded in 1919. At the time, banks were foreclosing en masse on farms in North Dakota, mainly banks located in Minneapolis. And the farmers of North Dakota got together and they started what they called the Nonpartisan League, which was a sort of, you know, not right or left movement, but really a localist, stay out of our state kind of movement, saying we want to keep our money here and we want to make sure our farmers and our banks are thriving and not out-of-state banks. They captured both houses of the legislature in the following election and immediately created a state-owned grain mill and elevator and the public bank, the Bank of North Dakota. They amended the Constitution of North Dakota to require that all state revenues and accounts be held at the bank, guaranteeing it a deposit base. And they put it in charge of the bank the Industrial Council or Committee, which consists of the governor, the attorney general, and the agriculture commissioner of the state. They then proceeded to make loans to farmers, some of them at competitive interest rates and others at discounted rates. They did have some trouble.
To North Dakota, I mean, they kept the money inside the state.
Yes, and this is a principle of almost all public banks, is that they're very regionally focused. In fact, they're designed to avoid competition with each other and also commercial banks. And the Bank of North Dakota is a great example of that because they have one branch and they have zero ATMs. And that's one way that they keep costs very low, but they also partner with community banks and community development funds, those kinds of things, in order to service your sort of retail customers and business customers. One of the major benefits of that is that North Dakota has the best community banking industry out of all the other states in the United States. There are more banks per capita, and those banks perform much better than community banks in other states. And part of that is because the Bank of North Dakota acts as sort of a mini Fed. Right, it extends credit to these banks. It allows them repo credit, right? So your after hours banking transfers in order to make sure the balance sheets all match up. They guarantee loans. They buy loans on a secondary market in order to increase the liquidity of local banks. And that independent spirit insulated them from a lot of the turmoil in Wall Street. They survived the credit crunch of 2009. They're currently thriving despite an oil bust in that state. They've returned over $1 billion in profits to the taxpayers in North Dakota over the last 20 years. It's a per capita of about $3,500 per taxpayer that they got in free services that they didn't have to pay taxes for.
So it's very important for listeners and viewers to get that one particular point. It services the people of North Dakota by using the money of the people of North Dakota to recirculate that money inside the state. And whatever profits are made by charging interest on the loans that they make to the farmers and others in North Dakota, the profit is not going into any private hands, but flows into the state's budget, which means that the government of North Dakota doesn't have to tax its own people and businesses the way another state might, because it has another source of income, namely the profits from circulating the people's money inside the bank.
That's right.
I can see that very clever to have partnered with local banks, because that means the local community bank doesn't see the Bank of North Dakota as a competitor, but as an ally. Mm-hmm. The competitors are the big national banks in New York and elsewhere who are unable to move in on North Dakota because, in a sense, they can't compete with what that bank has done. I assume that's why it's lasted for 100 years.
Yes. Well, they wrote it into the Constitution, which makes it very strong, and they guarantee those deposits against the full faith and credit of the state, which is a very powerful tool. The public credit is what backs our money. And by allowing it to also back a public bank, then you're extending that immense power of public faith into a space where public faith tends not to exist. Finance is a very predatory industry. It's very cutthroat, and there's really no quarter for social activity within that world. But as soon as you bring in the power of a state budget, a state that can compel revenue from its taxpayers, that source of strength creates a very solid base to build a bank on, to guarantee principal, to guarantee deposits.
In principle, then, there's no reason why the other 49 states in the United States could not replicate what North Dakota has done.
There are obviously legislative hurdles. There's politics with all of this.
Well, no doubt. But I mean, just in principle,
sure,
they could all do that.
They absolutely
and
could.
Or cities could do. In other words, it doesn't have to be the state. It could be a city. It could even be a county. It's variable.
It is. There are many cities that are currently looking into it, as well as states. Phil Murphy was just elected in New Jersey. He's a big proponent of public banking, and I think he's going to be looking into a public bank for New Jersey. Santa Fe, the city, had completed a feasibility study.
In New Mexico.
In New Mexico. It's pretty far down the line. And California is very active in this space. The treasurer, John Chang, who's likely a candidate for governor, his office just released a study looking at public banking as a solution to the cannabis cash problem, right? We have a burgeoning cannabis industry in California. Right. They operate all cash. They're shut out of the banking system. That means foregone tax revenues for the state. It means dangerous amounts of cash in unprotected businesses. So the treasurer was looking for a solution to that because it's in the state's best interest to make sure these taxes are collected. But all of these areas are looking into it for their own reasons. Los Angeles looking into it because they think it's going to lower costs, which it will. They think it will foster some independence from those financial institutions, which, you know, are constantly being disqualified from being able to use. And it's also kind of the end result of the divestment movement. You know, if you're going to ask your public university, your public entity of any kind to divest from harmful business activities like private prisons or exploitative labor practices, the only end goal that will really satisfy that is a public bank where the money of the people can be invested into projects that directly benefit the people and not just go around looking for the highest return.
My understanding is that in a number of other countries, public banking is a huge part of the total banking scene. That is, public and private banks have coexisted in various ways for many decades. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because it also establishes the feasibility and the viability of this as an institution.
Yes. Germany has one of the major economies, industrial economies in the world, and it has a huge public banking sector called the Sparkasse. And there are about 400 regional banks, and they all operate independent of one another, but they are a part of a consortium. And they came out of the 19th century sort of county-level treasurer's offices, right? You had a mayor and with a public trust, and they would open a little bank on the side that would take deposits from the public. That turned into essentially a public bank, and in the 20s, they reformed that into a more independent institution. That network of banks has been largely responsible for financing the green energy revolution in Germany. I think 70% of all loans made to clean energy projects were made by this public banking sector. And it's also one of the more profitable banking systems in Europe, a place that has obviously some very large banks, but they return upwards of 1.5% on assets, which is very, very good, you know, relative to other banks. And of course, they're led by a board of citizens, of workers at the bank, and elected or appointed officials. So they're answerable to the public. They have a public mission. They set aside profits for infrastructure development, affordable housing, sports programs. I mean, everything you could name that you would otherwise be paying with taxes, they're paying out of capital income from the people's money.
I think it's very remarkable. The German word Sparkasse basically means piggy bank, you know, savings bank, a place to put your money, which is the idea being you're putting it aside and it's for a rainy day or for something special or for a gift. And it's the community doing that collectively for itself through this institution. And from everything I've ever read, they're very popular in Germany. No politician, conservative, left-wing, right-wing, basically would dare to say anything against it, rather like North Dakota, where the politicians on both sides of the Republican-Democratic thing keep away from criticisms because it would be bad for their political career. It suggests that in the court of public opinion, if you can get a public bank started, your prospects of being well-established, well-loved in the community are pretty good, which probably would mean that the big private banks see this as a danger. Do you have any story to tell us or about opposition? Is there opposition from the big private banks? How is that being played out now?
Right.
Especially in a place like Los Angeles where you're making the effort to introduce it.
We are. I mean, if you take North Dakota, North Dakota is not a bastion of socialist political activity. But it is a very popular bank because people feel a sense of ownership and it does good by them. Right? They were able to fund a new water authority and get water trucks off the road in rural areas. And they had a flood in Grand Forks and they extend a line of credit. That goes a long way because you're talking about helping people without raising their taxes. In Los Angeles, there's some pushback. You know, Wells Fargo was at City Hall trying to argue that we shouldn't care about their CRA rating. That doesn't really mean anything. They send out...
That's the negative rating they got because of the scandals that they were caught up in.
Yeah, they were cross-selling accounts, and which is illegal.
Well, they created complete fictitious... I mean, they got caught doing all kinds of things, and it led to the end of their CEO. It was bounced out. I mean, it was really a major
their
scandal.
Their stock took a dive. It was bad for business for them, too, but... They'll send out the charities that they donate to, right? They have some nominal fund that they donate into certain neighborhoods to get a few people out there to make us look bad when we come in to say we need to divest from them. But in general, banks are very unpopular, and the idea of raising revenues and lowering costs without raising taxes is very popular. So I actually think that public banking is about to have a moment. There's a lot of high-level politicians who are seriously considering state-level banks at California, city-level, like I said. It's really having that time. In Germany, the Sparkasse are the bank of first resort, right? That is the first place that you go and open your checking account. And it's not until you're looking to make a bigger return that you go to the bigger investment banks. It forces those banks also to lend more productively, because instead of just stashing their money in government securities or making those safe bets that don't really drive the economy and move capital, it forces the for-profit shareholder-held banks to look around the economy and say, okay, maybe we actually do need to fund some businesses that actually hire people.
Is there any movement among the people pushing for public banks to organize them differently from private banks? In other words, is there any part of the movement that says a public bank should not have the hierarchical structure of a private bank. You know, what I mean is a board of directors of 15 people mm-hmm. who make all the decisions, and everybody else who has no input at all, who comes to work, does what he or she is told, and goes home, mm-hmm. versus a cooperative, a system in which everybody has one vote and the decisions are made democratically, what this institution is going to do, how it interacts with the community it serves, and so on. Mm-hmm. Is there any of that going on, or is the question of how the public bank is internally organized not something that the movement is concerned with?
We're very, very concerned with who manages and runs this bank. And I think the main effort of activists like myself isn't just to push the idea of public banking, because, again, politicians like it. They like ways to raise revenue that don't raise taxes. But it's creating the right bank that has the right input from the community. The Spark has have these boards of governors that are made up of community members, one-third, workers of the bank, one-third, and then appointed political officials. We see that as a much better model than just a bunch of bankers who all kind of sign off on what the executive says. Obviously, you're also talking about creating essentially a municipal institution. It needs to adhere to constitutional requirements, at least in the United States. And banks are inherently conservative institutions as well. So there's probably going to be a step-by-step approach, starting with a small-scale, sort of palatable version. And then once that starts to establish, if L.A. gets a bank, and then Ventura County and San Francisco, and then you start to see a California network spreads to other states, then I think you'll see more variety in the governance structures. You know, whether democratic rule can come into city departments and things like that, I think it's beyond my analysis at this moment. But I think having representatives of the employees and also of the community and the people who will benefit from this bank is really key at the top levels of governance.
How can a person who's interested, who finds what you've been telling us persuasive or has figured it out on his own or on her own, how can you get involved in this? How can you learn about what's going on and become, in some sense, a participant?
Well, like I said, there are a lot of places that have public bank movements already. And I think the most natural way to start, if there isn't one in your town, is to start with a divestment push. Figure out what your city is currently invested in. I guarantee there's going to be tobacco, energy companies, all kinds of extractive industries. And make a push for your city to divest from them. That's the first step. Then divest from the next one. And then the next one. Get your community behind the idea that the people's money need to be invested to the people's benefit and not to the people's detriment. That will lead to a public bank.
To the whole idea mm-hmm. that a public ought to have some say in what's done with its money.
Right. Not just a say, but that it should have absolute say, and that under no circumstance should public money go to benefit industries that harm the public. That those need to be redirected, kept regional, and with real metrics and a real mission to improve the lives of the people in its region.
We've come to the end of our time, David. Thank you very, very much for all that you've taught us. And let me thank all of you for tuning in, for watching, for participating. Be a partner for Economic Update. We want to thank you for doing that. And we want to thank truthout.org, that independent, remarkable source of news and analysis that's been our partner for a long time. So thanks again, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Execution of Martin Luther King. This is part two of a two-part program on the murder of Martin Luther King. More secrecy surrounds his death than even that of the Kennedys. In part one of this program, you heard the evidence of the innocence of James Earl Ray, presented by the man who became his lawyer until Ray's death in 1998. Dr. William Pepper is the author of An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. Bill Pepper has also been a friend of Martin Luther King's and his family for over 30 years. They first met when King saw photos of napalm-burned children in Vietnam, taken by the young Bill Pepper in 1966. Bill Pepper was present for the first passionate anti-war speech that King gave at Riverside Church in 1967, and he remembers that King knew that this speech would lose him political as well as financial support and might even endanger his life. 1 year later, to the day, King was assassinated in Memphis. Bill Pepper spoke at a San Francisco bookstore in February of 2003. In part one of this program, he began presenting his detailed, decade-long investigative work of the crime scene around the Lorraine Motel and his discovery of the identity of the person who received the murder weapon from King's assassin and disposed of it. Now you will hear how another piece of information led to the identity of a second group of people at the crime scene. An Alpha 184 team was in Memphis on the day of the assassination. Their presence was reported by Steve Tompkins, then a writer for the Memphis Commercial Appeal. He had written a series of investigative articles on the role of army intelligence in the infiltration of the Black civil rights movement. The first installment was published in March of 1993. Here is Bill Pepper.
It was to have been the first of eight installments. It became the only piece, but it was a very lengthy piece, and it dealt with the infiltration of the civil rights movement and Black leaders throughout over America by military intelligence, going back to the second decade of the 20th century. He traced the history of military intelligence's concern and surveillance of Black community leaders, and brought it all the way down, of course, to the Quantelpro operations in the 50s and 60s, particularly against Martin King. And Hoover's number two, of course, Tolson was an officer of military intelligence, and Hoover himself was given a rank of colonel, which he only discarded after the Second World War. So in this article, there was one little paragraph that caught my eye, and it said, in Memphis on the day of the assassination of Martin King, there was an Alpha 184 team there, and nobody understood why that team was there. Alpha 184, six-man unit, that was a sniper team. No one understood why they were there. So I was curious about that, and I went to see Steve, and I said, this is a whole other dimension to the case. I was beginning to form the opinion pretty clearly that Martin King had been killed as a result of a mafia contract. And there are any number of bounties on him in those periods of time. And a fair amount of money had been raised to try to get him killed. None of the occurrences were successful. And I figured ultimately one was, and this was a mafia hit. And that was it. But now all of a sudden into this picture comes one of the most secretive aspects of the government of the United States, the role of the Army, and the Army and military intelligence on American soil. And that bounded and intrigued me. So I said to Steve, will you arrange for these guys, whom he knew two members of the sniper team, will you ask them if they'll answer questions for me? And it took a while, and he said no, he wouldn't. He refused for the longest time. Finally, he said he would help. They would never meet with me, but they would trust him because he had never betrayed them. He was a former naval intelligence officer himself. And so he agreed to take questions from me, and they agreed to take those questions and answer them. As he got those answers back to me, these people were in Mexico, by the way. They fled the United States in the 70s because they thought there was a cleanup operation underway, and they were living in Mexico. The picture started to become clearer and clearer to me as they got the answers to these questions. It became evident that the military did not kill Martin King, but that they were there in Memphis as what I've come to believe was a backup operation, because King was never going to be allowed to leave Memphis. And if the contract was given and didn't work, these guys were going to do it. And the story they told was that they were briefed at 4:30 in the morning at Camp Shelby, the six of them. They started out around 5 o'clock. They came to Memphis. They were briefed there. They took up their positions. At the briefing at 4:30, they were shown two photographs of their targets. One was Martin King, and the other was Andrew Young. That was the first time I'd heard that Andrew Young might even conceivably be a target. But that's what he was. And the main informant told us most of the information, in fact, was the sniper who had Young in his crosshairs. Now, they were, as far as they knew, they were going to kill these people, and they had no regrets about it at all because they considered them as traitors and used very unkind words about them. So they were going to kill them, and they were prepared to do that, but they never got the order. Instead, they heard a shot, and the shot, they thought, each one that the other one had fired too quickly, and then they had an order to disengage. It was only later that they learned that, as they call it, some wacko civilian had actually shot King. Their services were not required. But that's how they worked. And this was not a one-off for these guys. They were trained snipers. You remember 100 cities burned in America in 1967. These guys were sent around the country, teams of them, into different cities. And these particular fellows had been in Detroit, Newark, and Tampa, and possibly L.A., and they were given mug books, and those mug books were the photographs of community leaders and people who were to be their targets. And they would be put in positions, and they would take out community leaders who would somehow be killed in the course of the rioting that was going on in various cities. So the assassination of Martin King was a part of what amounted to an ongoing program, covert program, they try to suppress dissent and disruption in America. Now, he was shot from the bushes behind Jim's Grill, not from the bathroom window. And he was shot as a result of a conspiracy that brought a man called Frank Liberto, who was a Marcello operative in Memphis. He ran a wholesale food place, in to see Lloyd Jowers, whom he knew. Jowers owed him a very big favor. And in addition to that, he paid him $100,000, and that was to take complete use of that grill facility for planning and staging of the assassination, and the room upstairs that Raoul, who was controlling James O'Rey, would have James rent and then keep out of most of the afternoon. The assassination, final stages of it logistically were planned in Jim's Grill itself, and there were a number of Memphis Police Department officers. Some of them were senior officers who were there. One of them was a black officer called Morel McCullough. He went from Memphis Police Department to the Central Intelligence Agency, where he worked for a number of years. Before he became an undercover Memphis police officer, he was brought back to active duty by the 111th Military Intelligence Group. It was on June 7th, 1967. So he was seconded from military intelligence to become a policeman to go undercover with a black group called the Invaders, a local group. So McCullough was very much in the frame in terms of all of these things that were happening. He participated in the planning. And Jowers named the other people who were involved in the planning as well. Each of these groups of people only knew what they had to know about this overall assassination scenario. There were two photographers on the roof of the fire station, and they filmed everything. They were still cameramen, and they filmed the balcony, the shot hitting Martin King, the parking lot, up into the bushes, and they got the sniper by just lowering his rifle. So the whole assassination of Martin King is on film. We negotiated for a year and a half with those guys who were psychological operations army officers to try to get it. Now, they didn't know there was going to be assassination. They were there to take photographs of everybody and everything around the Lorraine Motel at that point in time. The guy just happened, when he heard the shot, to spin his camera up into the bushes. And that's why they got the photographs they did. But they didn't know what was going on. The guy who shot King was a police officer, and he would only be told what he needed to know. The Alpha 184 team knew nothing about the mafia operation that preceded them. The Memphis Police Department knew of the mafia contract, and they covered that up. The FBI's role was to take control of the total investigation and to cover it up. There isn't enough time to go into the details of the evidence. I try to cover all of the evidence that we have and we eventually put before the court in the book. But needless to say, all of this started to flesh out in 1993 and 94. And I did a work in progress up to that time called Orders to Kill. And that book, like this book, was never reviewed in America. This book will never be reviewed in America. And the masses of people here will never know anything about this story because the book will receive no attention whatsoever. I mean, I have friends in a lot of media organizations, and they simply, and sometimes fairly senior journalists and reporters, and they say, "Bill, it's just not worth our jobs." And don't expect us to have you on in terms of this book. It's just not worth our jobs. So the consolidation of the control of the media is a major problem in this democracy, as it is in most democracies today. I don't know how democracy can function when people are not allowed information that's essential for the decision-making process, but rather they get propaganda continually. So Orders to Kill came out. It was unnoticed, except by the King family, whom I kept in touch with over the time, and they knew about the work. And at one point, it became evident that James O'Rae was dying, and he needed a trial desperately, or he would be dead, and there would be no possibility. He was dying of liver disease. He had hepatitis C, liver disease. So we put extra pressure to try to get this trial based upon a lot of the evidence we had. And we had a sympathetic judge, Judge Joe Brown. And Joe was very much inclined to give us a trial. And then at the midnight hour, I think just within the week before, I think he would have ruled in our favor, he was removed from the case. State made a motion that he was prejudicial, he was behaving improperly as a judge, and he was removed. The family came very strongly in support of a trial for James, and the family suffered as a result of that. They lost millions of dollars of contributions to the King Center, and they knew it would happen, but they struggled on. So the family and I met and made a decision, or rather, Mrs. King made the decision. I just laid out what options were left in terms of getting the truth out. And the one option that was left was a civil suit, civil action. And it was a wrongful death civil action that I proposed against Lloyd Jowers and other known and unknown conspirators. So we filed that lawsuit in 1998 against Mr. Jowers, Circuit Court in Tennessee, and we waited a year until we were sure we were going to get the judge we wanted to get. It was a black judge named Swearingen. And he had a reputation of being an independent guy. He'd been on the bench for a long time. He'd been involved in the movement in his youth, and he was also going to retire. He didn't have much long to go. As it turned out, this was his last case. So we got this case before Judge Swearingen, who was not in good health. We tried the case in 1999 for 30 days, 70 witnesses, 4,000 pages of transcript that today is up on the website of the King Center. KingCenter.com has all of the testimony of this. And for the first time under oath in any assassinations case in the history of this country, or perhaps any other, There is the complete picture of how Martin Luther King was killed. There is every answer to every question. There is why the bushes were cut down the next morning, who cut them down, who asked to have them cut down. There is every piece of information there for history more than anything else. It took this jury 59 minutes to come back and with an award and with a verdict on behalf of the family against Jowers and known and unknown conspirators in the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, and the city of Memphis. So the family felt and feels vindicated. They feel comfortable. They know now how it happened and why it happened. The reasons were all laid out. Martin King was killed because he had become intolerable. It's not just that he opposed the war and that was going to the bottom line of a number of the major corporations in the United States, those forces that basically effectively rule the world at this point in time, the transnational entities. But more importantly, I think the reason was because he was going to bring a mass of people to Washington in the spring of 68. And that was very troubling. He wanted to cap the numbers, but the military knew that once he started bringing the wretched of America to camp there in the shadow of the Washington Memorial and go every day up to see their senators and congressmen and try to get social program monies put back in, taken out because of the war. And once they did that and they got rebuffed again and again, they would increasingly get angry. And it was the assessment of the army that he would lose control of that group. And the more violent and radical amongst the forces would take control, and they would have a revolution on their hands in the nation's capital, and they couldn't put down that revolution. They didn't have enough troops. Westmoreland wanted 200,000 for Vietnam. They didn't have those. They simply didn't have enough troops to put down what they thought was going to be the revolution that would result from that encampment. So because of that, I think more than anything else, Martin King was never going to be allowed to bring that mass of angry, disaffected humanity to Washington. He was never going to leave Memphis. And that was the reason for the elaborate preparations that they had. Well, that trial, of course, was not covered. With very few exceptions, you probably never even heard of the trial. General Counsel of Court TV is a friend of mine. He said, Bill, we're going to cover this live because this is the most important trial in terms of the history of democracy in this country, these issues that are being raised, of any I can think of. Well, Court TV's cameras stayed in the hallway with the rest of them, except when Mrs. King testified or Andrew Young or Dexter or somebody. They never came in, and they certainly didn't cover it live. All the other media people came and stayed in the hallway and came in at selected points and came and went. None of this was ever reported. There was one ABC local anchorman who came in very cynical in his outlook, and he started to film for his local station. And as he started to listen to the evidence, he was fascinated and intrigued, and he decided he was going to stay, and he was going to film this thing. And he was told by his producer, don't do that, get yourself out of there. And he ignored that under threat of being fired, and eventually he was fired. But he tried, and he did film it, and he got his job back, ultimately through wrongful dismissal, but it was a chastening event for him. To sit there and to listen to this evidence and to realize that he was being told to suppress it. And to his credit, he tried to hang on. But there was a narrow window of about 12 hours where there was some minor reporting, and then it just all went away and never been heard of again. Except wherever it was raised, critics would start attacking. And none of them had ever been there, the trial. They started attacking the judge. They attacked the defense counsel. They attacked the jury. They attacked the King family. I mean, there were various shots of that sort to try to say that this trial was a farce. It didn't make any sense and made no difference anyway. The family decided that was basically it for them. They had the answers. The answers were on the record. But at least they would take it one step further and see if on the basis of all of that evidence now there could be an independent evaluation. So they asked for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and they visited with President Clinton and asked for that. He refused that request. Instead, he turned it over to Janet Reno, and she appointed her Civil Rights Division, put together a task force to do the investigation. And they did, and they came away with a whitewash, which was predictable and which was really the reason why we had wanted an independent commission to look at this, at subpoena power and the power to grant immunity from prosecution to get at the truth. But nobody was going to go that route. So that, I suppose, really is the end of the story at this point in time. But I don't think we really have much hope of going anywhere legally with it. James is dead. Family has won a civil action against one of the few people who could be sued. There are still some others, but one of the few people who could be sued. But I don't think we can go very much further with the case. It's important, I think, for Americans to look at this case history in terms of the health of democracy, particularly during these times, which are more troubling than ever before. One chapter of the book deals with Martin King. That's why it's a little different kind of assassinations book, because I think in many ways that's the most important chapter. Yes, it's important to have the details and the evidence of how this whole thing took place and how he was taken from us. But what's more important is to understand how such a leader comes forward, what his roots are, what makes him so special in terms of all of the co-opting pressures that are on people who emerge in leadership capacities today, and why has there been no one to replace him ever since? And why is there a strange inaction in terms of the involvement of people and leadership and organizations with respect to the major problems of economic situations of vast numbers of Americans in terms of the unequal distribution of wealth in America and the quality of life of at least 30 million Americans and their children. These movement issues are as much with us today as ever before, and yet there is silence. And what was there about King and his roots? I've traced Martin King back to John Ruskin, not to Gandhi, but to Ruskin. John Ruskin is the true father, the political economist in Victorian times in England, the true father of Martin King's political and economic philosophy and commitment to the poor of this world. He is depicted on King Day as a civil rights leader, and that's the way you're going to see him probably forever. But he was much more than a civil rights leader, and that's what no one in official capacity wants you to know. He had moved well beyond the civil rights movement by 1964-65, and he had become effectively a world figure in terms of human rights of people, and particularly the poor of this earth. And that's where he was going. And that's the area you don't really get into safely when you start talking about wealth, redistributing wealth, diverting huge sums of money into social welfare programs and health programs and educational programs at the grassroots. When you start going into that, you begin to tread on toes in this country, in the United Kingdom, and in most of the Western world. When you start associating with the poor of this planet and the exploitation of what's happened to whole cultures and tribal cultures in Africa in particular, and you see the results of the exploitation of Western colonial powers, and when you want to see a movement to not only arrest that process, which still goes forward today under different guises, but to actually reverse it and to give an opportunity for people to control their destinies and their own natural wealth, that's dangerous ground to get on. So King was committed increasingly to that kind of political view, which you will not hear about in terms of the I Have a Dream speech, which is typically what he's associated with. He wept in India, as early as 60, 61 when he was there, when he had never seen such poverty and such a massive scale. He said, how can people live like this, you know? King saw that, wanted to bridge it, and the solutions were too radical, too potentially dangerous. Jefferson was an idol of his. With all of Jefferson's foibles, remember, he said, you know, you need a revolution every 20 years. You need to sweep the room clean every 20 years, said Mr. Jefferson. You need that revolution. And King believed that as well. That's the background and the overview, I suppose, the summary of the case as it contains contained in the book and of my history of involvement with it. And I'm happy to be with you. Thank you for coming, and I hope it's been useful for you.
You heard the attorney and author, Dr. William Pepper. He became counsel for James Earl Ray after he became convinced of his innocence. As close friend of the King family, he helped them for 3 decades lift the veil of silence and deceit that still covers the death of one of the most important leaders of the 20th century. Bill Pepper is the author of An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, and he practices international law. You can find more information on William Pepper and his book on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org.
Post, a movie released January 12, 2018, reveals the stories of how the release of the Pentagon Papers created a fundamental challenge of the freedom of the press and alleged issues of national security. Few moments in American history have held the tension of the Vietnam War, as was the case in the United States in the early 1970s. The national rupture of that time, caused by Nixon's escalation of the war, widened. Young people and their parents, who saw no reason for the United States to be in Vietnam, clashed with the so-called silent majority. Daniel Ellsberg, our guest in this 1997 archive edition of Radio Curious, copied what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers in the fall of 1969 and released them in 1971. These top-secret documents unequivocally demonstrated that 4 previous United States presidents had continued to fight and escalate the war in Vietnam, notwithstanding repeated opinions from their many military leaders that the war could not be won. The Pentagon Papers focused national attention on the United States foreign policy and our rights as individuals to freedom of the press and freedom of knowledge. When Ellsberg and I visited by phone in March of 1997, he began with a description of the context of the time, 1971, when the Pentagon Papers became public.
All of the volumes of the paper in my office. was perhaps the second or third person ever to read the entire study, the first two being the people who were in charge of it. And what I found in that, as I say, doing research for the government, was that it was a 7,000-page record of lies, breaking of treaties, breaking of agreements, deceiving the public consistently over four different administrations, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson.
Could you tell us what some of those treaties were and what some of the specific lies were?
Well, for example, the United States had committed itself not to interfere with by violence, not to overturn the understandings in the Geneva Accords of 1954, which called for elections throughout Vietnam for a government of a unified Vietnam. It was that agreement that had led the Viet Minh, who were fighting the French colonialists, to agree to a ceasefire, an armistice in effect, for 2 years while they awaited those elections, which they expected to win. Well, Eisenhower expected them to win, too, as a result of a free election, as he said in his own memoirs. And therefore, the United States secretly set out to undermine those accords and to assure that anyone who favored carrying out such elections in South Vietnam, where essentially a client government, a kind of puppet government, under totally dependent on our support, was in power. Anyone who wanted to carry out the accords and prepare for those elections was repressed by our chosen ruler of Vietnam, President Ngo Dinh Diem, and imprisoned, actually, tortured, many of them killed, many of them driven to emigrate back to North Vietnam. And this was a very clear violation of our international commitments under the Geneva Accords, which had fatal consequences, basically, and led to the outbreak of resistance to Diem, support of that by the North, and to our decision to involve ourselves in the footsteps of the French. So having backed the, really pressed the French effort, which we were paying over 80% of the costs of the French attempt to reconquer their colonial possession before World War II, having made that our war, in effect, we then took the place of the French, really, in the eyes of the Vietnamese and in reality, and fought against a communist-led movement for independence and revolution in Vietnam. It was not a fight we were ever likely to win, and we did not win.
How were these lies suppressed and these unauthorized actions of the United States in violation of the accords and the treaties? How were they suppressed?
Well, simply by the, quote, normal workings of a security system, a secrecy system that had grown up during World War II in connection with the Manhattan Project, patterns of secrecy that were familiar to military systems of all countries, including ours, were extended to civilians, scientists and others, intelligence agents during World War II, people working on electronics and on nuclear weapons. And in the Cold War, we persisted in a kind of wartime secrecy, which came to be primarily a secrecy system directed against our own public and against Congress. Of course, there are secrets that need to be kept and that are kept from foreign powers or from enemies. But in peacetime, even in Cold War, so-called, those were the lesser part, really, of the billions of pages of documents that were stamped secret and kept out of political debate in this country to avoid controversy, to avoid opposition to the president's policies, to avoid finding any president out in lies or simply mistakes, errors, misjudgments that would hurt him politically. And in short, you have a system that's for the convenience of the people in power, for their reputation, for their winning elections, that is intended to subvert the democratic process. And the effect of that on foreign policy is that it isn't really regularly under our democratic control, on the one hand. And second, not being under democratic control, very foolish, very criminal, really, policies can be carried out, mad policies. Our Vietnam policy had a very strong strong tinge of unreality that amounted to madness year after year after year, especially as the costs grew very high. Even in the early years, it could be predicted. It was predicted inside the government that the eventual costs would be very high, and that was costs. And by costs, I don't mean just money. I mean deaths of Americans and many more times of Vietnamese. And despite those predictions, it always seemed more convenient to the president, Republican or Democrat, to avoid a failure, avoid an appearance of defeat before he faced the next election. He didn't want to go into that election charged with losing Vietnam in the way that Democrats were charged by the Republicans with having lost China.
Dan, it was these policies that you disclosed when you published the Pentagon Papers.
It was the...
The history of...
The secret. It was the secret policies, the secret escalations, the secret threats.
What was it that... What was it that finally moved you to decide to publish the Pentagon Papers? What was the straw that, convinced it?
It was not just a kind of academic desire to set the record straight. My job was in the government. I'd worked with classified material for years. I had been aware of lies for years. As far as I was understood, that was the way the government operated. In this case, I was aware that a new president, a fifth president in a row, was deceiving the public in the same way that all of his predecessors had. Nixon was continuing the war, continuing to make secret threats of escalation, which I felt he would be sure to carry out. I knew he was making secret preparations to carry them out.
This was the time when there were bombings beginning in Cambodia.
Well, I was aware, in fact, by the fall of 69, that the U.S. had been secretly bombing Cambodia since the beginning, since early February of 1969, and dropped hundreds of thousands of tons of bombs secretly on this country. Now, secretly is a funny word there in retrospect, because in fact there had been a revelation by the New York Times, by Bill Beecher of the New York Times, that we were bombing Cambodia. And you might think that something that was on the front page of the New York Times couldn't be described as a secret. But in fact, the day after that, the day that story appeared, the Pentagon simply denied it falsely, said, no, this is untrue, it's not happening. And in those days, before the Pentagon Papers had been revealed to the public had acquired an appropriate amount of skepticism. In those days, if the White House or the Pentagon just said, this is reality, that is not, they defined what was reality, no matter what was really happening. That was a dangerous situation for democracy, and I think the Pentagon Papers did help to change that.
So what was it that caused you to go public?
As I was saying, the awareness from inside, people who were working for Henry Kissinger and others, that Nixon was repeating this terrible history, which had cost so many lives on both sides so far, and that the public belief that the war was about to end under Nixon was simply mistaken. Now, if I had had documents to put out on Nixon's current policies proving what I believed to be true and what turned out to be true, I would have put those out. I wouldn't have put out history. But all I had in my possession, and I didn't have to go somewhere else. I'm described often as stealing these. I think people have the image that I took the initiative to get these documents illegally some way, which actually perhaps I should have done if I'd had to, but that wasn't the issue. They were in my safe, and the question was whether they should be only in my safe or whether the Senate should have them and whether the public should have them. So in the fall of 69, I copied these documents, which I was not authorized to do, of course, and I took them out of the Rand Corporation where I had them and copied them, and gave copies to Senator Fulbright, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in hopes, in his assurance, that he would bring them out in hearings. But he didn't do that. He was intimidated, really, against doing that for fear of what the administration would do.
Do you know who intimidated him?
Well, he asked four times to get them officially from Secretary Laird of the Defense Department, who simply refused and said I wouldn't be in the National get them in an official way, he shouldn't take the chance because of putting them out himself, even though he would not be breaking any law by doing so, but that the Pentagon would retaliate by taking away, for example, military appropriations, military aid appropriations from him and giving it to the Senate Appropriations Committee to deal with. He would lose jurisdiction. They would accuse him of unpatriotic behavior, of losing their trust, and indeed he would have lost their trust. They had earned his trust, I would say, or anybody else's, but he shied away from doing that.
This is an archive interview with Daniel Ellsberg, who made the Pentagon Papers public in 1971. The movie Post is about the Pentagon Papers and freedom of the press issues, which I recommend you see. It was released in January 2018. This is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
Dan, is there anything that you regret or in retrospect would have done differently with regard to publishing the Pentagon Papers?
Well, as I say, I could have taken stronger efforts when Fulbright didn't move immediately in 69 to get them out some other way earlier. I kept hoping that Fulbright would bring them out as late as late 70, and it was only when I gave up on that I gave them to the New York Times.
Let me ask you, if I may,
put them out earlier in answer to your question, but I must say that I'm not sure they would have had as strong a political impact earlier.
Let me ask you, if I may, what you believe the role of government officials should be when they believe that the president is making a catastrophic mistake. And the example that we have is the revelation of Secretary of Defense McNamara in his book that was released last year, in which he said he was wrong in furthering the war in Vietnam. Should he have spoken up earlier?
I think so, definitely, although simply and do a little more, let me be more specific than say that he should have spoken up. I really asked myself what I thought he could have done, and I realized that instead of lying, which he did in the most explicit concrete ways to Congress over the Tonkin Gulf incidents, for example, in 64, and later again and again and again, and very specifically to a Fulbright hearing in 68 investigating the Tonkin Gulf incident. Instead of that, and instead of refusing to testify to crucial Fulbright hearings, Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings, in February of 1966, which is after he tells us he had become totally disillusioned in the war, he and Rusk refused to testify. Instead of that, he could have simply agreed to testify. And as a matter of fact, he could have arranged that even if the president had strongly wanted him not to testify. At that point, if he could not persuade the government, or the president, which of course was his first responsibility to try to do to his point of view, if he felt the president was going disastrously wrong, which it would seem that he did believe, instead of then following the president blindly down a path that he thought would cost hundreds of thousands of lives needlessly, Vietnamese and American, he could have simply encouraged the Fulbright hearings, presented himself in front of them, and in fact, he could have encouraged them to ask for documents, and he could have produced those documents.
Why do you believe he did not do this?
Sure, it didn't occur to him any more than it would have occurred to me at that time. I don't say that to exonerate him or me. We should have been able to see such a possibility. But at the same time, if you're asking why it didn't occur, I'm sure that it was unthinkable for an executive branch officer to, in effect, change sides and work with the congressional power as a restraint on the executive. Now, that's what I did do eventually in 69. And I am not the person to point a finger too strongly at all at Secretary McNamara for not doing it in 66 or 64 because I didn't think of it either. And I think we both should have done that. So if you ask what I should have done, I think it's the same thing that McNamara should have done that earlier. If you say, I wish I'd done something earlier, I wish I'd gone to Congress as early as 64 when I was aware they were being disastrously lied to about Tonkin Gulf and about the plan for escalation. taken all the documents that I had in my safe at that time, which in the Pentagon now, which later were published in the Pentagon Papers, but seven years of war later. If I had done it earlier, before the bombs were falling, I don't think the bombs would have fallen. I don't think any Americans need have died, and that's a very heavy burden to bear. So I bear that at my lower level, along with McNamara, who certainly could have done the same at any given point. Now, I did learn, I think, better, and I did change my behavior. McNamara, to this day, I'm glad that he did tell the truth about his views now, 25 years later, and it really is better late than never. But I have to join the many people who felt that he could have saved many lives. I believe that he could have ended the war had he acted on his convictions earlier, while the war was on, to end it, instead of following a very misplaced loyalty exclusively to his boss, exclusively to the president. Of course, he's right in saying that a cabinet member holds very strong loyalty to the man who appointed him, and to the president of the United States, to the commander-in-chief.
Let's jump ahead, if we could.
The only loyalty he owes, I think, is just terrible from a human point of view, from an American, from a Democratic point of view. When the president is going off the tracks, you can't afford to act as if he were a German Führer and deserved loyalty to the death.
Dan, let's jump ahead, if we could, and ask if Elliot Richardson, who was the Attorney General in October of 1973, followed your lead when he refused to fire Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor who was investigating Nixon, and instead resigned, and his second-in-command, William Ruckelshaus, also refused to fire Archibald Cox and resigned, and the third one down did fire Cox.
Yes, the third one who did fire was named Robert Bork, by the way, later a controversial nominee for the Supreme Court. But if Richardson had not done that, of course, we wouldn't probably in the end have gotten the White House tapes, and Nixon would probably have escaped the impeachment hearings, which led him to resign. He would have stayed in office, and I believe he would have continued the war. People think the war had ended by early 73. That was not Nixon's intention. It was being entangled in Watergate that led him to postpone renewing the bombing, as he planned to do. He tells us that in his memoirs, and so does Kissinger. And the war was going to continue in the air indefinitely, as far as he was concerned, and at least till the end of his term. So I think that Richardson's correct action, and patriotic, conscientious, and courageous action, and that of Ruckelshaus, was essential to ending the war a couple of years earlier than, and perhaps much more than that, than it otherwise would have. It should be taken as a kind of standard. Now, obviously, there were great differences between what he did and what I did. But in both cases, it amounted to, it was in a broader category of saying no to the president. And in circumstances where others would not have done so, where he had not done so earlier when he should have, perhaps, at various times. But he finally found the light and the strength to do that. And that set, I think, a very important example for others.
Let's address, if we may, what you see the authority of Congress to be in banning these kinds of covert operations, be they in Cambodia or parts of Vietnam or the other portions that you delineated in the Pentagon Papers, or forward now into our time in Serbia and Nicaragua?
Well, there's a broader question. You mentioned covert operations. There's the broader question of whether the Constitution should be followed in giving Congress the really exclusive power to declare war, and their intent of the founders of Congress was exclusive power, not the president, not shared with the president, to get us into something that properly be called a war, as opposed to a retaliation for an immediate or a defense of our forces in a very immediate tactical situation, but where they might be attacked, or a raid or something like that. But the founders of our Constitution, I think, very wisely felt that we would be protected from unnecessary or wrongful wars much better if that decision rested not in the hands of a single powerful executive leader, but in the hands of Congress. And we've gotten totally away from that. There have been moves, and with some limited success, but only limited success, for Congress to regain some of that power, largely thanks to Vietnam, partly thanks to the Pentagon Papers. But there's they haven't gotten it back nearly as much as they should. Now, there's the narrower question, not of war, but of covert operations, that is, operations that the president does not want to acknowledge as being U.S. operations. He wants to tell the world they're not happening, or if they are happening, that the U.S. has nothing to do with them, and if that is discovered, he wants to be able to deny plausibly that he personally was in control of them. He wants to blame it on some underling or a rogue elephant, something like that, which is the function of the CIA, to take the blame for secret actions that the president has ordered and to carry out those actions. But if they're discovered, to take the blame for them. Should there be such actions in a democracy? I would say no. That subverts whatever convenience they may have. Of course they can work. Of course they can be effective. In some cases they can be convenient. But to operate in that way is the negation of democracy. You can't have accountability. You can't have popular sovereignty when the nation is carrying out, or actions are being carried out by officials that are carefully, secretly prepared in such a way that you can't find out who ordered them or whether they're really happening or what's going on. There can't possibly be any accountability for such actions. So I think if you want to have a democracy, and we should want to keep a democracy, I believe, for not just for sentimental or traditional reasons, but because it really is the best form or the least bad form of government, as Churchill put it. And it does protect us from, as the founders of the Constitution hoped and planned, it does protect us better than any other system from the worst thing that can happen to a country, and that is an unnecessary or wrongful war. So I think that Congress should act against such covert operations, but I have to say they are not doing so. They have been, on the whole, co-opted by, bought out, basically, by the executive branch, by letting certain members of Congress and the intelligence committees in on this heady brew of secrets. They're intoxicated by secrets and by covert actions, just as the executive is. They're flattered. It's even better than sleeping in the Lincoln bedroom to be told a criminal and really deadly, lethal James Bond actions that they can participate in making. It's very exciting stuff and makes them feel very important and gets the adrenaline flowing. And it makes them feel very much of an elite, which, in effect, they are, and it's a dangerous kind of dope to be addicting Congress to, secret dope, inside dope.
Well, Daniel Ellsberg, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you the question I ask all of my guests at this time, and that is, could you please tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, I wasn't ready for that. It so happens that I can do that very well. I read yesterday, in one day, David Harris's Our War, What We Did in Vietnam and What It Did to Us, and I can recommend that to everyone. It's the best book I've seen on Vietnam, and it addresses it as a moral issue and reminds us of the evil that was done in our name.
Well, Daniel Ellsberg, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
Daniel Ellsberg located, copied, and released the Pentagon Papers to the press in 1971. The book Daniel Ellsberg recommended in 1997, when this interview was recorded, is Our War, by David Harris. There are over 630 archive editions on our website, www.radiocurious.org. The email address is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.